commence the meeting.
Commence the meeting.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I can get you to take your seats, we'll commence the meeting.
You got the hammer, too. You got the hammer. Sankey's just not listening.
No, he's not.
Hey, Sankey, that means you.
Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dan Richards, and I am the acting chairman today, the only commissioner in attendance. We have Commissioner Sutton and Commissioner Rogers both en route, and so what we're going to do today is go through our public testimony items on the agenda. If my fellow commissioners are back by then we will continue on to our hearings and action items. If they are not back at that time, I'm going to adjourn the meeting for an hour. Recess the meeting for about an hour, and we will commence once they get here. Introductions. Of course, Chief Nancy Foley is here with us today, and Assistant Chief Mike McBride. It's a real pleasure to have both of them here, particularly Mike. Don't get to see him all the time at the meetings, and he's our local guy, so we love that. Also, Sankey Mastrup is here from the department, and we will move on. I think the first item we have is announcement from results from executive session, and I will turn the microphone over to Deborah Barnes from the Attorney General's office, who represents the Fish and Game Commission.
Thank you, and good morning. There's only one announcement from yesterday's executive session. Under Government Code 11126C18A, the commission was briefed on an ongoing security issue. Thank you.
People in the back say they can't hear.
Was your microphone on?
We got a low mic over here, although hopefully we won't need to hear from the attorney again today. But nothing personal, of course. At this point, to start off, I forgot to mention early on, if you want to speak on any agenda item, fill out a green card, which is on the table out there, and bring it to John Fisher or Sherry at the end of the table, either table here. If you have written materials you want to turn in when you speak, give it to staff. Don't bring them up to the dais here. There's a bunch of wires. You'll trip and fall, and then we'll need our attorney again. I do not have any speaker cards for item 16, so we're going to move on to item 17. I believe, and actually I haven't confirmed this, is Wade Sin in here?
Yes.
There's Wade. Great. I knew Neil Manji's arranged for you to be here, so I wasn't sure what to expect, you know, with Neil being involved. Just teasing. So if you want to come up, Wade, we have number 17, receipt of Department of Fish and Game presentation on Trinity River hatchery mitigation requirements and hatchery goals for steelhead. If you could introduce yourself also for the record, Wade. Thanks.
There we go. Testing. Okay. Yes, thank you, commissioners, staff, department, for allowing me to come here today and speak on this issue. My name is Wade Sinan. I'm an associate biologist for the department, and I'm headquartered in Arcata, California. Today's presentation was really spurred by some public testimony in your April meeting regarding hatchery steelhead on the Trinity River from Caltrout, Tom Weslow. So today I'm going to give a short presentation, just give you the information that we have so that you can see where the concerns may lie. Just also want to mention, in the interim between April meeting and today, we've given two presentations to the Trinity Management Council and also their stakeholder group, the TAMWIG, on this issue. They were pretty in-depth presentations. Today's presentation will be a little condensed from those. Also, Cal Trout and Friends of the Trinity River submitted a written letter to the Resources Agency on this issue, and that response letter was sent out to those respective agencies on June 9th. And I have copies of those if you so desire to see those copies of what the Resources Agency response was. So without any further ado, we'll go through this presentation here. Again, you see the title here is Trinity River Hatchery Steelhead Mitigation Requirements, Escapement Goals, and also some trends in abundance. So real quickly, I wanted to run through what the mitigation goals are in the production cycle. So the Trinity River Hatchery, TRH, was built to mitigate for lost habitat above Lewiston on the Trinity River. The Trinity River was cut in about half with the completion of the dam. So there's 100 and some miles above the dams that are being mitigated for. Our current steelhead production goal at the hatchery is 800,000 yearling juveniles. Those are released on site. We collect 2 million eggs throughout the run to meet these production goals. And based on 3,500 eggs per female, we need about 571 females to meet the egg take goals. And that number looks a lot smaller than the, you know, it's a small number of fish, as you'll see later. But really, we need to take eggs throughout the run to preserve genetic integrity of the run. So we you know, spawn many more fish than the 571 females. And then the steelhead are spawned late December through March. And the yearlings are then released the following year from the hatchery between March 15th and May 1st, and our target release size is 150 millimeters. And all of the steelhead currently receive an adipose fin clip to identify them as hatchery fish, and the Hoopa Valley tribe is performing that task currently. So what we have here is current Trinity River Restoration Program escapement goals for naturally and hatchery-produced fish. And these escapement goals have been in several documents and were developed quite a long time ago, and we've kind of had these goals since. And they're in, you know, as I mentioned, like the EIS for the Trinity River Restoration Program. For steelhead, the stated goal is 40,000 adult natural spawners and 10,000 adult hatchery spawners. And I won't go into the other species, but you can see there what the goals are for those. So I mentioned that the production goal at the hatchery is 800,000 yearling fish. This graph here shows how many fish were actually, steelhead were actually released from the hatchery by brood year. And you can see that for quite a few years, we did not meet our production goals. We only met it one, two, three times in the first 20, almost 30 years. This arrow here signifies when there was a hatchery modernization completed at the facility. Basically went from dirt ponds, earthen ponds, to concrete raceways. And also we've had more disease prevention technology and things of that nature. So essentially, you can see that after that point, we have come a lot closer to meeting our release targets at the hatchery. This dashed line represents the 800,000 fish. So you can see that in all but about 5 years, we've actually met our production goals here recently. And now this graph illustrates the actual number of returns to the hatchery. As I mentioned, the escapement goal for the hatchery is 10,000 fish, as stated in those goal documents. And that dashed line represents 10,000 fish. Well, again, here you can see that for a lot of years, we weren't even close to meeting the escapement goal at the hatchery. However, since about 2003, we've actually met the goal 3 out of 5 years. And you can see that we've had quite an increase since about 2001. It's just been steadily rising. And the average return for the whole time frame is about 2,700 fish. If you look at 77 through 1995, it's almost 1,200 fish. But since 1996, we've jumped that average up to 5,200 fish. And then these last 6 years or so, it's been close to 9,000 fish. So those goals are intended to be kind of an average. They're not a ceiling. So,
pardon the interruption, but could you explain a little bit for all of us exactly what escapement is so that, you know, I mean, are you guys detecting these fish with coated wire? What? How are you? And well, the definition of escapement, because there's some folks here that you know,
okay, sir.
We're trying to get around jargon, which I know for us is easy, but if that, and there's folks watching on the video.
Certainly. Escapement means fish that escape the fisheries. So these are fish that have survived to spawn. So if they come into the hatchery, they've obviously escaped the fishery. So they're entering the facility, and these are actual counts. These are not estimates. These hatchery returns. So these have no bias associated with them. So these are very hard numbers. So again, you can see that, you know, we've had these bigger returns in more recent years. However, the escapement goal of 10,000, we have not averaged that. However, we have surpassed that 3 years. Oops, times. Oh. Okay, this graph is actual run sizes. Now, these are estimates. The department operates a tagging weir on the main stem Trinity River. We're actually tagging steelhead to develop run sizes annually, although you can see some years we weren't able to get them. So you can, again, see kind of the trends here of the steelhead population. The mean run's been about 13,000 fish. And when I say run, that does include harvest and escapement. So it's just whatever comes above the weir, we're estimating. Pre-96, we've averaged about 11,000 fish. And then post-95, it's been close, a little over 15,000. This is the mean run here, this dashed line for the time frame, about 13,000 fish. Again, you can see an increase. Now, this does include wild and hatchery fish. So this is all the fish that come above the weir, whether they be wild or hatchery. Okay, and this slide really illustrates the crux of the issue here. As I just previously said, the hatchery's been getting, you know, the last couple of years about 10,000 fish, a little over. However, these show estimates of hatchery and wild fish. The black bars represent wild fish numbers. The green bars, hatchery fish numbers. Again, this is above Willow Creek Weir. You can see in the early 80s, we had some decent wild runs. Hatchery returns were not that large. 90s, we saw suppressed runs for both hatchery and wild fish. And then here again recently, in recent times, we've had these increases in both the wild, but real large increases in the hatchery returns. And you can see, for example, in 2007, we had our largest estimated run on record since 1977. And we had about 54,000 fish. And the real issue here is that we estimated about over 45,000 hatchery fish in the system. And this is the issue that I think some of the groups have taken exception with, that we're getting too many hatchery fish back to the system. And the potential issue with that is the ecological and genetic consequences of those fish spawning or competing with wild fish in natural areas.
Wade, let me ask you something on that slide. The hatchery fish, I'm seeing 45,000 hatchery fish back in 06 or 07, whatever that is.
Right, 07.
Those are all tagged fish, so you know that.
Well, I was just going to go into this. The way we estimate the runs is we estimate a total run size. It's based on a mark recapture experiment. So we have this total run size, and then we partition that run size into wild and hatchery components based on the percentage of adclip fish we see at the weir.
You do it more than once?
Well, it's a continuing process through the season. So we're trapping fish as they migrate.
Okay, good. Then that's even better, because when I really look at that, and I'm I think it's interesting on the number of hatchery fish. Matter of fact, just tells me what we're doing is working really well. But what's most encouraging there, to me, is the doubling of the wild trout. Although not keeping pace, of course, with the hatchery fish that we're doing, that's a doubling right there, and that's impressive.
Yeah, that is a good sign. We take it that way as well.
Matter of fact, it's more than doubling on some of those years.
The one thing, the issue that's been raised is that we have this escapement goal of 40,000 natural fish and 10,000 hatchery fish. And as it's been stated, it's approximately reversed. However, as you mentioned, we're seeing some good signs here.
I think those are great signs, and I think it's a great goal. But I think the reality is it's a little tougher to get the wild fish that didn't spawn there to begin with coming back. So these are what, three-year-old fish?
Three, 4, and 5-year-old fish.
I mean,
fish.
Minimum is really what I meant.
These are all adults.
Minimum three-year-old adult fish.
Yeah.
And so, it takes a little while for that cycle to occur, and I see that occurring right there.
That's right.
That's great. That's great stuff.
It also rates mention here that the restoration program is only about half complete right now. So in terms of affecting wild populations, we still have some things we're doing to the river. Now, the flows are in place as a result of the record of decision. That's based on water year type. And when you think about it, what are the first fish that are going to be able to take advantage of flows? Well, it's the hatchery fish. There's going to be 800,000 or close to it every year. So if survival conditions improve, they're going to be the first to experience that better survival.
And the river itself can easily sustain this and more. So it's not a matter of the hatchery fish taking food source from the wild trout, is it? Or is it?
Well, there's some of that. When these juveniles are released, 800,000 fish, they are competing directly with fish
course.
In the river.
Right.
There's that issue. There's also, some genetic concerns, and there's actually been a lot of, both theoretical and empirical data that suggests that hatchery fish are inferior to wild stock.
Inferior in what ways?
Well, they don't fare as well in the wild. Like, for example, if a hatchery fish spawns in the wild, it has genes that were adapted to a hatchery environment where, essentially you're being fed, you have controlled conditions, things of that nature. So they haven't had to adapt to the changing environment. So the concern is that a lot of these hatchery fish will stray into wild fish areas, spawn with natural fish, thereby passing their genes on to the offspring, which could weaken the stock overall. It's, as I mentioned, there have been some studies looking at that. The department actually proposes to try and evaluate the extent of strain. It's not really how many hatchery fish stray. It's how many hatchery fish spawn with wild fish in wild areas. And so we know that there's a high level of strain right below the hatchery. This is the case for all hatcheries.
Wouldn't it stand to reason that over time, if you keep having the wild trout numbers go up like they are, you'd be releasing less hatchery fish?
Well, I was going to save that for the end here, but essentially there's biological issues related to this. There's also legal issues. The hatchery is actually owned by the Bureau of Reclamation. It's a federal hatchery. The state operates that hatchery. So there are mitigation goals in place that the state adheres to. So we have these juvenile production goals that we are trying to produce every year. I had mentioned that we had these a couple of presentations to the TMC and TAMWIG. The result of one of the TMC meetings is they've actually sent a letter, and I have a copy of that here if any would like to get a copy of it, that asked the Bureau of Reclamation. Is asking the Bureau of Reclamation essentially how are the mitigation goals developed? What are the mechanisms to change those goals? And what's the next step in the process? The department fully supports that. We, sit on the TMC, willing to work with all the stakeholders. That's kind of the legal process that, we've got these goals, and they were created to, again, mitigate for lost habitat. So we need to find out what the process is of how we might change those, if, in fact, there's consensus to do that. So again, this slide kind of illustrates the issue. There's just a lot of hatchery fish in the system, and I must state, you know, these run estimates are not without bias. Steelhead are notoriously hard to estimate because of the time of year that they enter the system. They're coming in the winter, late fall, winter, and our weirs are in till about mid-November or so, and we're only estimating what we call the fall run of the system. There's also a winter run and a summer run, and those numbers aren't shown here. And so in terms of the wild numbers, that's only going to go up on this graph for those runs because we do count everything that comes into the hatchery. So, you know, that's some of the issues that surround the steelhead. And you know, those estimates are plus or minus 25%, somewhere in that neighborhood. So they're not super precise, but you don't find data sets like this in California or many other places for a steelhead very often. You mentioned just add a little water. This is a graph showing the mean releases from March through June at Lewiston. With the record of decision, we now have higher releases into the river that mimic warrior types. And you can see that from 1970 through 95, we averaged 635 CFS during the emigration period, essentially, of steelhead. And now from 96 to 2007, we've more than doubled those flows. I don't have the slide here. I did some analysis of that, and there was a positive relationship between steelhead returns and flow. But, you know, it's significantly been changed. And as I mentioned, the steelhead are released March 15th, and that's about the time, a little after that, is when they start ramping up the spring flows. So these fish have better migrational flows and temperatures. So in summary, some conclusions. Hatchery-produced steelhead have experienced much higher survival the past 5 years. Total run size for Trinity River wild and hatchery steelhead have been stable or increasing. And the increased return of hatchery steelhead appears to be related to increased flow releases at Lewiston. And that ends my presentation. Is any questions I can ask or answer?
The only thing I just was going to comment on, and I'm wondering if, because number one, hatchery-produced steelhead have experienced much higher survival. You were talking about the genetics. I'm wondering if the hatchery genetics are getting stronger from the roe that you're collecting. Generally,
I'll speak to that. Generally, the science, you know, the theoretical science about hatchery fish suggests that you know, continued hatchery spawning practices and the environment actually theoretically is, you know, not good for the long-term health of the fish because
right.
of domestication, inbreeding, things of that nature. And in fact, we get very few wild fish that come into the hatchery, so this hatchery stock is pretty segregated, at least in the hatchery, from the wild stock. The opposite is, of course, the issue.
Right.
However, you know, they've just been doing gangbusters, you know, and this kind of leads a little bit into the regulation thing later on. You know, we have all these excess fish. It's within your power, and this is a tool in your toolbox to change regulations to, you know, take advantage of these excess fish, and that's why we've proposed, you know, a two-fish bag on steelhead.
Yeah, I think at some point in time you'd want to say we'd want to be releasing less hatchery fish as the wild population gets to where it should be. I mean, think perfect world, someday you don't have any.
Well, that might be debatable because of the mitigation issue of this hatchery.
If you have the hatchery, if you have the run back to what it naturally was or in excess of that, why would you? I don't care about the mitigation at that point. The mitigation was successful. At some point, you say, what do we continue to put hatchery fish in for?
That could be the case, and I think it'll be interesting as we go down the road with investigating how these mitigation rules are, you know, enforced or changed. That could be the case. However, you know, you have to, as I mentioned at the start, we've lost 100 miles of main stem habitat and many, many, many more miles of tributary habitat that we just aren't producing fish there now. So it's going to be difficult for the lower half of the river to actually, you know, make up for the whole basin.
Sure.
We hope that it will increase, and it has been.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, that would be great. And, hey, maybe we'll have a Klamath situation and we'll take the dam down altogether.
Yeah, exactly. 20 years from now, we'll be surprised. Thank you so much.
Okay.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
We have two public speaker cards on this issue. Tom Weslow, followed by Paul Weakland. 3 minutes apiece.
Good morning, Commissioner and staff and Fish and Game staff. Unfortunately, I didn't have my hard copy of this document that I wanted to go through. Is there a chance we can get that one of those last slides put back up there? I think it would be really beneficial. I'm Tom Weslow, North Coast Manager of California Trout. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and the fact that you scheduled the presentation and that Fish and Game provided the good information that they did. I think our big concern is if you go back one or two more slides is really the very telling one. That's the one. Our concern is the goal of the production there is 10,000 hatchery fish and 40,000 wild fish. And if you look at that graph, we have basically an inverse relationship. And the questions you were asking, the easiest one I could give you is those surplus hatchery fish have a negative impact on the wild population. There is no information I've been able to find anywhere that shows a surplus of hatchery fish is good for natural production. It's always the opposite. And the types of impacts that you have are competition with naturally produced fish for food, for rearing space, for spawning, direct predation. We did a study and over in the first mile or two of the river, over 250,000 naturally produced fry were being eaten every year by the released hatchery fish. So you've got the competition, predation, you have behavioral changes and impacts of the fishing because of the hatchery production. You have behavioral changes of the naturally produced fish when a wall of 800,000 hatchery-released juveniles come down the river. You've got the potential for disease. And when these fish, some of these fish don't always leave the system, and that residualization actually compounds all of these factors. And when you were asking about these fish spawning in the wild, the most recent study coming out of Oregon basically said the fitness of these hatchery fish, each generation may be reduced by as much as 40%. Fitness is more or less their ability to survive and reproduce. Okay, that's an extreme case, I would say, but it's also well documented in literature, and I can't find any papers that say anything other than look out for this problem. And now I also want to be clear that I'm not bashing the folks at the hatchery. If anything, they're doing a great job. They're being really successful. The question might be why? And it's a really simple answer of why. Just add water. With the record of decision started in 2000. Look at 2 years later, all of a sudden these runs are just skyrocketing for naturally produced and hatchery fish. It's the same number of hatchery fish coming out of the hatchery.
Thank you. I want to ask you a question. What would you suggest?
Exactly what I think I heard you saying and what the department's looking at. I think we need to address how many fish are being released. The goal is not to release 800,000. The goal is to get 10,000 hatchery fish returning. So we should be adjusting that release to an appropriate rate to get 10,000 fish returning, but not 47,000 fish returning.
Yeah. And let me ask you something, because I'm just curious on this. I don't have some vested interest or even an opinion. I'm curious. Wouldn't really the objective be to have no hatchery fish?
That would be in the long run.
Yeah.
I think Wade said the problem is it's 109 miles of habitat that have been lost.
I get it, but I mean, wouldn't the ultimate objective be no hatchery fish?
Yes.
Yeah.
If we could get the natural production to that level,
that would be good. Where it starts slowing down on the hatchery fish and the wild fish are growing, at some point in time they're going to pass the hatchery fish and they get up to the numbers we want to have. What do you need the hatchery fish for?
That's
and I'm asking that question not in a I want to get rid of them. Do you need them at that point?
The hope is to There's two parts of the restoration program that you need to be aware of. One is the increase in flows. The other is physical changes in the habitat,
sure,
in the watersheds and in the main stem.
Mm-hmm.
That is still underway. We're expecting that that will help that wild population continue that increase. But my warning to the commission and the department is those surplus hatchery fish will have a negative impact and will mute the ability of those wild fish to continue improving and increasing in population.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Weakland.
I've never said this before. Commissioner Paul Weakland. Never been to a commission meeting with only one commissioner. All right. Let's talk about the numbers. Well, first, we question the numbers and don't believe they're accurate. They're only estimates. They said that there's a 25% margin of error in their numbers. I believe it's a lot greater than that. The department often says 50% percentage of error in their surveys. Now, who is accountable? It said for the last 20 years that very few fish were being released, yet we were paying full price for these fisheries. We are not getting the benefit. Where is the worth and value of these hatcheries? We've been led a line here for 20 years that they're beneficial, and they are not. But if you were in a hatchery setting out in the woods, and you were wanting a hatchery, and it was all being paid for by tax dollars, you'd want to be able to remain there, too. I think the sham should be exposed, and I think that we do not need hatcheries. All of a sudden, their estimates have gone up in the last few years. We believe this is artificially inflated to justify their existence, which is not good. We know that the sport harvest, the first day of sport fishing season... Hey, John. We know that the first day of sport fishing season usually diminishes the number of hatchery fish that are put into the fishery. The number of fishermen that go out and catch your limit on opening day, that negates all of the hatchery fish. But they're not just hatchery fish that they're catching. Now, we know that there is a mechanism in nature. We have documented proof for over 20 years that when there's too much genetic diversity, these fish that are coming out of the hatchery are hybrids. They are artificially spawned. They've created a hybrid right away. Now, these hybrids have a... negative effect. We have found that there is a mechanism in nature when there's too much genetic diversity present, it creates large die-offs. Die-offs occur. This is nature's way of cleansing and purifying itself, like on the Klamath. What is happening with these hatchery fish, the introduction of these genetically altered and hybrid fish, is environmental terrorism, ecological sabotage, and crimes against nature by destroying the gene pool and the genetic reservoir of our native fish. Let's just look at the California golden trout, our state fish, which is now on its road to extinction because of the introduction of hatchery fish into the waterways. What has the department said? Oh, well, the genie's out of the bottle. Pandora opened the box. There's no way of getting it back. We just want to continue doing this. They've been doing that for 20 years. So these mitigating circumstances, this litigation...
Thank you, Mr. Weakland.
...needs to be ended.
That concludes public testimony on item 17. If there's no other discussion, should we move forward? Until we get a quorum, which we're looking at having at approximately 10 a.m., we're going to move forward to item 20 and then item 22, which are receipt of public testimony. So moving forward to item 20, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to the migratory game bird waterfowl regulations for 2008-2009. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for August 8th. 2008 in Carpinteria. Dan Perigary.
Good morning. Dan Perigary with the Wildlife Branch. I thought I'd have time to get a lesson from Steve on all these instruments up here. I have a real brief PowerPoint. I'm very sorry that Commissioner Rogers isn't here, because the first little bit of it is personally directed at him. How does this thing work, Steve?
You can lay it on me. I'll report
okay,
it to
okay,
you.
Well, it'll be on the web. He can watch it later.
I'm sure he will.
Last year, the commission had the time to look at the status video from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and this is the results. Sorry, forward that way. The results of the May survey, and Commissioner Rogers said, boy, that sure looks like fun. So I took him up on the offer, and this first little bit of this is how I spent my summer vacation, which is actually May. The service has flight suit and helmet rules, so they made quite a bit of fun of my Fish and Game issued Nomex stuff. We've shown this slide to you, and there's actually a little bit of a reason for me doing this, so bear with me for a sec. This is the May survey area of Fish and Wildlife Service. It's often touted as the largest running, most comprehensive wildlife survey in the world. It's been run since 1955, and it is largely the basis for duck harvest regulations. The blue circle is the neck of the country that I got to do, which isn't showing up too well, but the survey is just basically west of the Missouri River and east of the Rockies. And it was quite fun for me to do a duck survey and see bighorn sheep. I now understand why Commissioner Sutton hunts pheasants in South Dakota, because you can't go afoot without seeing one. Even over that relatively small survey area, the conditions varied quite a bit from north slope looking stuff. But this is what we saw an awful lot of. Farmed, dry prairie. Reductions in CRP acreage, and of course drought conditions in that neck of the woods are pretty severe in some areas this year. It got me to thinking about our survey, and there's a lot of numbers here that don't mean much, but that 5,000 miles of transects, that's the area that I got to do. So when you fly 5,000 miles at 150 feet above the ground, you get to see lots of stuff. But it got me thinking about the whole survey's 55,000 miles, and just comparing to our survey here in California, we survey about 1,400 miles. So just trying to put it in context. As a result of these surveys, these are kind of subjective assessments. The lower right is the stuff from last year, and basically blue is a good thing, red is a bad thing in this graphic. The bigger map to the upper left is the current year's assessment. You see a lot more red. This is particularly bad in the pintail nesting area, and a lot less blue. So conditions in the prairies, particularly the southern prairies, are not good this year. And that kind of leads me up to my brief little presentation on waterfowl stuff. As I said earlier, we have traditionally set duck regs based on that survey. Yesterday at a meeting in Arlington, Virginia, a new paradigm in duck harvest management in the West has been established, and we're now going to set our duck regs based on the status of Western mallards. We've been working on that for quite a while. So I'll give you a little bit of background to that, because it is such a large shift in how we're going to set duck regs in the West. And a little brief thing on the Western ducks, the Department of Proposals, I'll just summarize in case there's any questions, and then wrap up with a quick summary of the regulatory events that are coming up ahead of you before your adoption meeting in August. Now, I'll use the term Western mallards, and a lot of people think of the West and cowboys and stuff like that, but that's not what we're talking about. The service and Canadian Wildlife Service, when I say service, I mean U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've been banning ducks for a long time. And these blue circles are essentially what we call reference areas. And you can see some kind of tendencies there, that in the upper left graph, ducks that were banded in the upper northeast part of the continent tend to stay to the east. In the middle, it gets a little more swarmy. Particularly in southwestern Alberta, the graph in the lower left, you can see quite a bit of dispersion from those ducks. And then, of course, in the West, birds that are banded in Alaska, British Columbia, Oregon, Washington, and California are very highly associated with the West. It's hard to see, but there are a few dots down the central Mississippi flyways out of the West. Most of those come from Alaska. An important consideration for us, age ratios are an index to recruitment. They're taken from the harvest. It's the ratio of young to adults. When you have a high age ratio, you had a good production year. And you can see that in the West, it's almost always higher and usually less variable. And that's an important thing. We'll talk about why we focus on mallards.
All right, hang on for 1 second, because okay. I don't understand what I'm looking at.
So okay,
PF, AF, MF, CF.
Yeah, John continues to get me on jargon, and I'm not good at it because we have a lot of it. Those are the four flyways, Pacific Flyway that we're in, Atlantic Flyway, Mississippi, and Central. So if we go back, the Atlantic Flyway is pretty much the eastern seaboard. The middle part of the country is the Mississippi and Central flyways, and the Pacific Flyway is the 11 western states, including Alaska. So when you look at the light blue, our flyway, you can see, compared to, say, the central flyway, which gets most of its ducks right out of the main part of the prairie, our mallards are almost always more productive, and by a long way. Now, this has important harvest management ramifications. If you've got a duck stock that's highly productive, you've got the ability to harvest more of them on an annual basis. So from looking at those banding data, we know that mallards in the West are largely distinct from the mid-continent mallards. They're much more productive. There's two reasons for that. One of the prairies go through a boom and bust cycle. When it's dry like it is now, it's not productive at all. But when those prairies get water, they're very productive. That is the duck factory of the world, frankly. And out here in the West, we have a much longer nesting season. Mallards here can start as early as February and go all the way through July. So for those are the kind of reasons that result in that higher recruitment. Because of those things, the Pacific Flyway has been advocating that we pay attention to these stocks of ducks for a long time, for about 30 years. So we've been working at that. When the service sets duck harvest frameworks, they did it based on that May survey. So hopefully this is my last bit of jargon shorthand in this thing. BPOP is shorthand for breeding population. So we had that mid-continent, what we call the mid-continent survey area, which was that first map I showed, and it was the status of those ducks that set the regulations for all four flyways. We knew there were ducks breeding on the eastern side and there's ducks breeding on the western side, but those ducks were never explicitly considered when the service set the regulation frameworks. The kind of concern that Pacific Flyways had for a long time. In 1998, think back to that mallard swarm of recovery distributions, those dots were band recoveries. The service started to setting regulations in the Atlantic Flyway based solely on the eastern breeding population. But our regulations were set based on the mid-continent. So what that means is when Saskatchewan was doing really good, our duck regs might be liberal, even though we get very few ducks from Saskatchewan. Some, but very few. So they took this big pot, and knowing that it's not black and white, and we said, we've been saying for a long time, that we can do better than that. And so now we are. Yesterday at their meeting in Arlington, Virginia, the service decided that we would now incorporate Western mallards explicitly in the decision-making process. The definition of Western mallards currently is those birds that we have measures of in California and Oregon and Alaska. And I made this a little more complicated now. That 98% of the mallards that are surveyed in California and Oregon, which average about 480, stay in the Pacific Flyway. 2% find their way over to the Central and Mississippi. When you look at Alaska's ducks, about 70% of them stay in the Pacific Flyway and about 30% slide over. When you look at the mid-continent population, which is much larger, nearly 7 million mallards, 10% of those come to the Pacific Flyway, particularly the northern tier of a flyway, Washington, Idaho. Those are more mid-continent birds. We see very few of them in California. But 90% stay in the central Mississippi. So for the purpose of this year and for however long, from starting in 2008, our regulations will be set on those three benchmarks. So here's the surveys that are driving this thing. California, our survey, which we revised, we've actually been doing it since 1948, but we revised it in 92. It's a state-operated survey. Oregon does their own survey, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has been surveying up in Alaska since 1977. So those are the objective measures, and those surveys are being used for those reasons on the right. It's an estimate of total birds. There's a sound sampling design. That means we have a standard error associated with each one of our estimates. There's adjustments made for detection. These are all aerial surveys, and we know that when you fly, you don't see 100% of what you see. And there's fewer, actually only one missing year in Oregon's data stream. You'll see that in a second. Those cross-hatched states and provinces, Washington, British Columbia, Nevada, and Utah, surveys are being conducted there, but they don't currently meet those four criteria. They're either pairs in British Columbia, which is a different number than total mallards, or they have no standard errors associated with them, which is the problem in Washington, Nevada, and Utah. It's just a point estimate annually, so there's no estimate of precision. And in those surveys, there's no estimate of detection probability. So those estimates are less valuable than the three green ones. And, of course, what's left here is we still have Pacific Flyway states that contribute ducks to our harvest, particularly Western Montana, Idaho particularly, actually, and Western Wyoming, Western Colorado, where those states do not currently conduct surveys, and we're hoping that they'll come along here as we continue to move forward. So that's going to be the basis of it. And what this leads to is a really fundamental thing that I wanted to make sure you had a chance to understand. When we use mid-continent mallards as the surrogate for duck harvest, why do we use mallards in general? It's the number one duck in the harvest. It comprises 37% of the total duck harvest in the country. So for those two reasons, it serves as a pretty good surrogate for ducks. They have a very high harvest rate, so when you manage off of western mallards and you feel the need that you need to restrict harvest on western mallard or on mallards, you're going to restrict harvest on the other species as well. They mirror that trend. So, and the last, probably the most important thing is that as the most abundant duck, they've got the most banding data. So all of our data sets are most robust when we consider mallards. But now we're talking about using western mallards to set our regs in the west, which means how do mallards that are born in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California serve as a surrogate for those species like green-winged teal, widgeon, and all the other things? And they don't. And we're not done yet. It's taken us 30 years to get this far and get some accountability for the ducks that we're contributing, that we've still got some things to do. And what we're asking the service to do here, along with the other flyways, is we need to find a way to explicitly, we'll use that word a lot now in duck business, which is to put numbers on things, to use mathematical models and computer simulations to actually try to estimate what it is we're trying to accomplish. One of the things we do there is a computer system called optimization, where given the conditions you've got, given how you think the system operates, and given your outcome, what decision is optimal in that case? Well, right now we'll have an optimal decision based on the status of western mallards. What we need is a jointly optimized decision, one that explicitly incorporates ducks from the mid-continent region along with our ducks in the west. Alaska mallards used to be counted as mid-continent ducks. They're now counted as western ducks. So there's an opportunity to take some of those ducks from, say, the southwest Alberta world and call them western ducks because they're pretty strongly affiliated with us. And then lastly, my point about our sister states, if they can get on board, it will continue to help us quite a bit. So the status of ducks now, the green line in the middle-ish is California. You can see we had a 23% decline in our breeding population estimate for mallards in California. I didn't put standard errors on these things, but if you did, you would find that this year's estimate is not statistically different from last year's, and it's not statistically different from the long-term average. Oregon's BPOP dropped a little bit, and of course our total in Alaska stuff is we're waiting on the Fish and Wildlife Service to publish their results. So we won't have those numbers or the frameworks until your August meeting. Now, in the initial statement that you went to notice with in May, the department had four sort of general proposals, and I'm just going to list them here, and so if there's any questions from you or the audience, we can have a context. Our white goose populations are doing quite well. They're well over objective. We've got proposals through the flyway to increase the harvest on those. Those will require changes in the federal frameworks, and we won't know which of those options are going to be available to us until the rest of the flyway weighs in. This one, I think you'll hear from the Black Brant, coastal goose, breeds on the YK Delta in Alaska, winters primarily in Mexico, very popular with a relatively small number of ardent hunters. We have a management plan for that goose population as well as all the others in the Pacific Flyway, and that plan calls for a liberalization in harvest this year based on its population status. However, early word from Alaska is that the foxes raised holy heck with them, and so we're just barely over the liberalization threshold. If we end up having a bad production year this year, we'd end up kind of whipsawing the regs back and forth. So when we get better word from Alaska, we may actually retract that proposal, at least ask you to consider that. In the past, we've had a special late season hunt for white geese in the Imperial area down in the southern end of the Salton Sea, and that's was originally targeted at white goose depredation. The geese that stay there after the hunting season switch off of public land onto private land. We had a request from the Imperial County Board of Supervisors, the Ag Commissioner's Office, and others to reinstate that late season, so that's our proposal for this year. White goose stocks are doing very well. And then lastly, your initial statement has a range of season dates in it because we don't know what the frameworks are. So procedurally, we have to account for that in our proposal at this time, and we'll have those frameworks shortly. So my last slide on this is just an update. Yesterday, the service established this new modeling management approach for mallards that we talked about. They did adopt one for scop, so we fully expect, unless there's a tremendous rebound in the scop breeding estimate, that we would expect some restrictions in the frameworks there. And we made quite a mess of the canvasback thing last year. The service actually adopted a bigger bag limit than was in their strategy last year. We hadn't accounted for it in our CEQA documentation, so last year we had to go through some gyrations on our regulation process for canvasback. They formally adopted a change to that this year, so now we know what the rules are, so that's not going to be a problem for us this year. In a couple of 3 weeks, we expect to see their breeding population estimates, which will give us our Alaska stuff for our Western Mallard frameworks. We'll get our harvest estimates sometime in late July. The Pacific Flyway Council will meet the last week of July. That's where consideration will be made of our recommendations for changes in frameworks, like on white geese and stuff like that. The Service Regs Committee will meet again on July 30th and tell us then what the frameworks are. And those frameworks tell us what the maximum bag can be, the earliest seasons can open, the latest they can run, and stuff like that. And your adoption meeting will be August 8th, and at that time we'll bring very specific recommendations to your table. And that was all I had. And I'm sorry Commissioner Rogers couldn't get credit for letting me go spend 19 days flying around the Rocky Mountains.
I'll make sure he knows that.
He should be here any minute. Before you step away from the microphone, I have a couple questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
About a month ago, some big wigs from the Fish and Wildlife Service were in Sacramento for a little powwow on pintail. I haven't really heard a whole lot about pintail today. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel on possible pintail bag limit increase this year?
There's always light at the end of the tunnel, John. It may be a train.
Right.
Of course. This year, I would say no. At their meeting yesterday, the service agreed with the recommendation from all four flyways to maintain the current harvest strategy for pintail. And given that slide I showed early on with all that big splotch of red across the southern prairies, I would tell you that the probability of the pintail BPOP going down is probably better than 50-50. What did come out of that meeting, and I really shouldn't speak to it if CWA or COA wants to, because I was off flying around in Montana when that meeting happened. But
there
is some progress.
Talk.
So I can tell you where we think we're going, but I wasn't there.
Well, you know, and as you know, the commission's always interested in all the waterfowl, so pintail is, you know, if there's any changes, keep us posted.
Yeah.
Last question I have is, you have any T-shirts yet? Your Got Data T-shirts. I was going to tell the new commissioner that.
Oh.
Some of those data slides up there, and Dan has some that are much more crowded than what he showed today, and he was going to do a T-shirt that says Got Data with the, you know, about 50,000 data points on there.
One of the pluses and minuses of the migratory bird world is that there's lots of folks involved, with the federal government having a high interest in it, and there's a long tradition of a lot of data being gathered. I mean, lots and lots and lots of it. And sometimes I think we almost sink in it. And I've got a graph that I've showed some folks that is just a swarm of curvy lines with standard error bars, and you can't see a thing in it. It's so complicated. And we were thinking of making a T-shirt that take off on the got milk, but haven't got around to that. Anything else?
Thank you. Okay. We have one public speaker on this, Bill Gaines.
Commissioner Richards, members of the department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. Would like to talk specifically about some minor concerns that we have in regards to black brant. Dan Perigary just mentioned that the brant numbers are still very much in doubt, and we may not have any firm numbers that will dictate what the framework ought to be for brant this year until maybe next month. But nevertheless, our concern is that in those years when the brant populations do dictate some liberalization in the seasons and bag limits, we believe that number of days, along with an increase in daily bag, should be laid out as options for managers to consider when looking at liberalization. Unfortunately, the current Department of Fish and Game eyesore on brant limits it only to an increase in daily bag. The eyesore says 0 to 30 days. We've been at 30-day brant seasons now for several years. This year, should we see an increase in brant limits or in brant populations, or in future years, we'd like to see the Department of Fish and Game eyesore open up to, say, possibly 0 to 45 days, so at least managers and this commission would have the option of looking at an increase in daily bag along with an increase in season length. So we'd like that to be considered in the future when the department is preparing their ice source. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We can move now to item 22, receipt of public testimony on proposal to amend Section 300, Title 14, related to upland game birds. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for August 8th, 2008 in Carpinteria. Does the department have any presentation on this at all? And any speaker? Well, Dan, did you have a?
You're going to get tired of me, I'm afraid. Dan Perigary with the Wildlife Branch. Because the waterfowl had so many agenda items here in a block, it didn't make good sense for us to bring the upland game person down. So I've got the proposals and some background I got from Tom Blankenship, our upland game coordinator. So if there's questions that arise, I might be able to give you a shot, but I won't go through the list. You know what the proposals are.
Nothing major to highlight. Okay. Do we have any cards on that, John? Two speaker cards on that. Bill Gaines and Jeff Novak.
Commissioner Richards, department staff, again, I'm still Bill Gaines with the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. On this item, I'd like to testify on not only on behalf of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, but also the National Wild Turkey Federation. Last year, I believe the meeting was in Truckee. NWTF and the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance testified in regards to the additional days added on to the youth, or the turkey season, rather, to provide for some additional hunting for youth. The department I saw last year proposed to add those 14 days onto the tail end of the season. California Outdoor Heritage Alliance and the National Wild Turkey Federation very much wanted to see the department in the future, which would be this coming spring season, to consider adding those days onto the front of the season. Now, the intent of the additional youth season is to increase hunter recruitment. And those in this room that hunt turkeys, I hunt them very often, I'm very familiar with it, know that as later in the season you go, the breeding season starts to get over, the toms get harder to call. Those toms that are left are very, very smart. It's really tough on the tail end of the season for the birds to be called in to provide some good hunting opportunity. If the Department of Fish and Game wishes to increase hunter opportunity and youth recruitment with the youth turkey season, they need to strongly consider putting those 14 days before the season, not after the season. Now, last year when we testified on this, the Department of Fish and Game said that they would do some data survey, talk to some of the hunters, and see how the season worked out on the tail end of the season, and they would strongly consider adding the possible 14 days to the front of the season this year. Unfortunately, to the best of our knowledge, the ISOR again simply would limit those 14 days to the tail end of the season. I know we don't have a quorum here today, but I would ask the commission to consider, since this is the spring turkey season, it's not going to happen until late March. We have plenty of time to deal with this, that the commission would consider asking the department to go back, rework that piece of the ISOR, and at least offer the option for this upcoming 2009 spring season to add those 14 days on the front of the season so the additional youth season can reach its goal of increasing hunter recruitment instead of simply being 14 days that do not offer much hunting opportunity nor much hunting success. Thank you very much.
We don't want it to be too easy on them, the kids.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, we went through the same debate with waterfowl on the Youth Waterfowl Weekend a few years ago, but the good news with waterfowl is as the season gets later, typically the hunting gets better. So we decided to do it on the tail end of the season in this part of the state. Now, I will tell you, there's many, many states that offer additional youth hunting seasons for turkeys. Most of them do it before the season. So California's, really the exception when it comes to this.
Bill, would you get me that data?
Oh, on the other states?
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more than happy to.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Every state would be perfect for me, so I could see that.
Sonke, we have opinion on that? We're looking at it?
Yeah, we've looked at that, and there are a bunch of issues associated with it. We can come back to you. wasn't prepared to talk about it, but the longer the seasons we have, the more enforcement issues there are. Our turkey season's very generous as it is.
I'm not talking about extending the season. I'm just, what, or Bill's not. He's talking about just changing the youth hunt to the front end versus the back end.
Yeah, you could
same,
do it.
Same term.
You could do it in the front. Generally, there's some people like it, some people don't.
Sure,
you know, depending on where you hunt, some of the better turkey hunting is actually at the end of the season than before, but it depends on the weather conditions. So most of the turkey hunting is on private land, too, so the landowners can pretty much manage that for themselves on who and when they allow people to hunt. Private landowner wants to offer opportunity for kids, they can let them have first crack during regular turkey season. So the landowner, where the bulk of the turkey hunting's going on, has the opportunity to do that already.
Okay.
Right. But we can come back with some more discussion.
Let me respond to that quickly, though.
I'd rather you just get me the information. We don't have to debate that today.
Okay. I will get it for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Novak.
Morning. My name's Jeff Novak, and I'm a veterinarian in the high desert town of Ridgecrest, and I'm an avid falconer for over 30 years and a member of the California Hawking Club, of which I'm representing here today. I'm also an active member of Quail and Live in it. For many years, falconers had the same early upland game bird season as the archers, and this was a three-week season starting in mid-August and extending into September. This season was suddenly eliminated in 98. The quality of falconry was diminished by this event, as there were several important aspects of falconry and the hunting of game birds that are benefited by this early game bird season. There are certain limitations to hunting with a bird of prey that affect when you can hunt anyway. Usually between February and July, for instance, our birds are put up for the molt, so new plumage can be acquired. Mature birds are often put up even earlier to fatten them up to prepare them for breeding, the breeding season. Mature birds that are not used for breeding still often show behavioral changes brought on by the breeding cycle that make hunting with them difficult at best. They appear distracted, and the potential for loss increases. The degree of weight control used to practice falconry will preclude breeding and molting well. Therefore, the season from March through July is not usually a time falconers hunt with their birds. There are only a couple of species of raptors capable of consistent success on upland game birds, and that's goshawks and Cooper's hawks. They're the most proficient at hunting these birds, as they have the speed and the power and the ratting out capability needed to capture these game birds. Generally, falcons like to catch birds in the air, so birds such as upland game birds that rat out and cover are difficult for them to catch. Budios like red tails and Harris hawks are often too slow to pursue upland game and are easily eluded and cover. There are only a handful of California falconers hunting with goshawks and Cooper's hawks in chukar and quail areas, so the impact on these game bird populations would be minimal. Baby hawks are usually feathered and ready to fly by the end of July, and it makes sense to have an early season for upland game that would allow young hawks to learn how to hunt the upland game birds by hunting the younger, more inexperienced birds, and then growing in experience with them as the season progressed. It is very difficult with the season as it stands to be successful with hunting a hard-flying bird like a chukar with an inexperienced hawk in the ear. One of the biggest benefits of an early season would be that we wouldn't have to worry as much about getting our bird shot to death by foolish gun hunters. Most falconers, you know, have lost a bird to gunshot. I had one of my goshawks shot in 93 despite having checked the area for shooters, and it would be a great benefit to have a time when we could hunt without constantly looking over our shoulder worrying about who might try to kill our hawks. Thank you for your consideration of the issue.
Okay, hang on for a minute. Tell me what the season is right now. By the way, nice timing.
The season is October 1st through February 28th, I believe.
Okay, and that coincides with duck season. I think, 15th it starts or something like that?
And
20th, whatever.
The gun hunting season for upland game starts usually around October 21st.
Okay. And you're proposing a season when?
Well, the way it used to be.
Which was?
It was usually like mid-August to early September.
So really a completely separate season.
Yes.
And that would be an adequate length. That's actually a shorter season, but that's adequate for your purposes.
It allows us to get a young bird trained up because they're a screaming mess when you first take them out, and they have to get focused on game. They need to chase some things that are maybe a little, won't fly as far, and a little easier to catch.
So really talking about, you're proposing a three-week season versus the three-month season you have right now, but you just want it in front. Is that what I'm understanding?
I'm talking about this in addition to the season that we have.
Oh, okay.
There are a lot of other factors.
I was confused by that.
You know,
okay.
That time of the year, that it's hot, but it's calm in the high desert where you don't have tons of wind. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of wind. You got eagles up.
How many falconers are there in your association?
I think around 300.
Mm-hmm. Most of them up in the desert?
A lot of them are. A lot of them are in the Southern California area.
Yeah.
So there aren't very many of us that actually do a lot of chukar and quail hunting. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was devastating when they changed us away from the archery season. We were always included in that 3 weeks.
Do you have a license when you're a falconer hunting?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a hunting license and a falconer license.
Okay, cool.
And I have a breeding license to breed the goshawks. Yeah. I got a lot of licenses.
Yeah. I wasn't questioning whether you had your license. I was actually questioning whether they had them. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the department, just like to clarify, we support the proposal to recreate the early season falconry season. And just as a question, there are about 600 licensed falconers currently in the state. It's a small group of very dedicated individuals.
Yeah, I think that's terrific.
They're very highly regulated, and they have federal and state regulations and oversight. So
great. Good. Sounds like you might be in good shape.
Well, from a procedural question, so Sankey, is that one of the alternatives in the current package before the commissioners, so they could select that next month?
As you remember, having read it very carefully, yes, it's our preferred.
I didn't read it very carefully because I trusted you, but that might be a problem. I don't know.
But you could look it up on the web, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I knew that was coming.
It's actually one of our three proposed projects for the upland game: the fall turkey season in San Diego County, the expansion of the Eurasian colored dove bag limit, and this falconry season for upland game birds. So it's one of our three keynote changes we're requesting.
Great.
Do we have any real opposition to any of those? Any groups that are opposed to it?
The majority of the traffic we've gotten so far is people wanting to kill more Eurasian doves than we're even advocating. So, but very little comments so far.
On the Eurasian doves, didn't you say it was like an unlimited bag limit or something like that?
Actually, I'd have to look exactly what
that
was.
I think it was. I mean, how could you kill more of them?
No, it's not a limit. Dan, do you remember? I'll look it up.
Oh, yeah, we're really stretching if you're calling me up on this. But I did do it a little bit from Tom Blankenship. And prior to last year, Eurasian collared doves were not a legal game bird in
Correct.
Our state. And last year, the regulation allowed them to be taken as part of the 10-bird daily bag.
Okay.
The proposal this year is to, if I got it right, is no bag limit during the season.
Right, that's what I'm saying. How can you complain about the bag limit? There's no limit.
Yeah.
That may be comments from last year.
Yeah, we talked about this before. I remember it, and I was kind of surprised by it, but they want to get rid of them, I guess. They're some concern about it.
There are concerns about their potential impacts on native nesting species. They're an invasive exotic. They're spreading throughout the whole continent. If I understand some of the public comment, there are folks that question, because some states are not having any regulated season at all, so that they would be allowed to hunt doves, Eurasian collared doves, 365, and you can see the potential problem, I think, there. But
okay.
Some states haven't taken that.
Got it.
Let me get this straight, though. Does that mean that Sankey didn't carefully read this package? Is that what I'm getting here? I'm just trying to clarify. I'm not, you know. That was our last public speaker on that item, and the rest of the items, we need a quorum to consider and vote.
Okay, let's do this.
They should be here in about 5-10 minutes.
Well, let's do this just so we have enough time to get them oriented and everything. We'll adjourn to at least 10:15, and if we have any updates at that point, we'll update from that point and go another 15 minutes, but right now we'll adjourn to
recess.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Till 10:15.
So good morning, and I say good morning from me. I'm very sorry to have missed the meeting yesterday. I strongly recommend to you that none of you get the 24-hour flu that I think probably John Carlson gave to me, even though I didn't have physical contact with him. I think he wished it on me. But that is not something I'd wish on my worst enemy. I'm a little delicate today, but anyway, take it away, John.
Thank you, Richard. Good to have you here. We now have a quorum. We are going to go to item 18, request to go to notice for regulatory action to amend section 29.85A2A, Title 14, related to crabs, open season. Sankey Mastrip has a little explanation on this for the commissioners.
Good morning, commissioners. Had a check there. This is a request we wanted to discuss with you. You have in your packet a memo describing the issue, and Maria Vojkovic will give you a quick rundown because we need some guidance, and you're at a pivot point on whether to take action or not. Maria?
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Maria Vojkovic for the Marine Region, and the memo that you have in front of you concerns the recreational crab season for the northern portion of the state in the counties of Mendocino, Humboldt, and Del Norte counties. Currently, the regulations allow the sport fishery to start fishing on the last Saturday of November, and the commercial fishery typically begins on December 1st, unless there's some reason for a delay for that due to the crab condition. And the commercial fishermen are allowed to set their fishing gear typically 64 hours before the opening of the commercial season. And this year, the way the calendar sits, the recreational anglers will actually get to go fishing, start their fishing after the commercial gear is in the water, before the season opens, but after the gear is in the water. And so we have received several faxes and letters from individuals on the North Coast asking for more of an opportunity to take recreational crabs or crabs recreationally before the commercial season starts or the commercials start putting out their fishing gear. In 2006, this issue was brought up to the commission to set a uniform opening recreational season throughout the state, and you rejected that option and chose instead to set up what we currently have. The season structure now is set for whatever Saturday in November. In the South, they have an earlier opening. They open the first Saturday of November because the commercial season opens the 15th of November. In the North, this was the last Saturday for recreationals because the commercials started on the 1st of December. The way the calendar sets up this year, they get less time to fish before the commercials start. So the question is, do you want to entertain a regulation change that would permanently change the recreational opening date, or do you want to leave it the way it is and the calendar changes every year and some years they get more time and some years they get less time? That's essentially what we're asking to have you make a decision on. The reason there's this need to make a decision.
How many days are we talking about here, by the way?
I believe it's this year it's only like one day.
Okay.
And typically I believe it's 9 days would be the maximum they would have.
No, I'm talking about the overlap the problem where they got shorted or they got an extended
period? In a different calendar year, it would be nine days would be the maximum amount of time the recreationals would have before the commercial starts. But this calendar year, it's a one-day difference.
More or less? They have one.
That's the only day. I mean, one day is what they get as opposed to 9 days.
Okay.
And so it because of the calendars and Saturdays being the opening date, it changes year to year. This needs to be either noticed today if we want to have regulations in effect for this crabbing season. This is out of cycle of our normal sport fishing regulations. So it's kind of important to either say, yes, we're interested in entertaining this year, or no, we'll put it on the regular cycle and it may be available for the anglers in next fishing season. I hope I wasn't confusing.
Maria, we're all for adaptive management. But what's the department's recommendation here? What do you think makes sense?
From a biological perspective, the recreational fishery is very small compared to the commercial fishery. November is a time period where the crabs are changing from being very soft to harder. So the further back in the season you go, the more soft crabs you end up interacting with. So it depends on what option you choose. We've made put together two options. One is the first Saturday in November, which is the longest time period and the earliest part of the season, or the second Saturday in November, which is mid-month. So,
is there any crab? I mean, are we having any shortage or issues with the resource itself?
No.
Okay.
No, the resource is fine.
Yeah, my instincts would be always to.
We have public commentary.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Actually, we do not have any public speaker cards on this issue.
Oh, we don't on this issue. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry, Dan.
My instincts would always be to give the recreational crabbers as much opportunity as we can within reason, as long as it's a manageable situation for the department. If we jump around and change it every year, and that's you're telling me that that's manageable, so that we gave them 9 days in advance every year or whatever it might be, great. If it becomes unmanageable, then you just, and I also candidly am very fond of, these are the dates every year, and some years it's going to be really good for you, and some years it isn't. It makes it very simple for everybody because they know what the dates are. So I'd be, is it manageable for us? But my leaning would be to try to give them some advance opportunities if possible.
Sonk, you have a question?
Yeah, just a little bit of context or history. The commission has had a long tradition, although nowhere is it really specifically required, that where you have a fishery that's both commercially and sport harvest, the sporties have typically been allowed early crack at it before the pros kind of come in the game. The other issue here is traditionally the department, the commission, has not liked changing regulations once we have regulations, and it makes it kind of difficult for enforcement, because right now a person walks into the jury chamber and says, I got a regulation that says it started this date when we changed it mid-course. So we traditionally aren't fond of changing things in once we already have regulations published for the year. However, we do have a heart. And when the director and us looked at the situation, these are the same folks that don't have salmon fishing this year. Rock fishing is very constrained, and we're thinking, this would be something nice to do. Normally we wouldn't, so we said, let's let the commission decide this one.
So what is your recommendation? To repeat.
I was afraid you were going to ask that of me. I think my recommendation is going to be in the form of a riddle. Basically...
Should we start calling you Yoda?
Yeah, right. if you would ask me, part of me says no because we have a process. It's a change in course. It's going to be very challenging to get this rulemaking through the process and actually have the law in effect by the opening date. It's going to be tight. It worries me just out of, you know, technical reasons and enforceability issues. On the other hand,
this is an automated licensing. Don't worry about it. It won't be that long.
Now, I've got this one. You missed our second drubbing yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I'm really sorry. Actually, of all the things yesterday, that was the one thing I would have loved to have weighed in on.
Yeah, you'll get your chance. Trust me.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem there.
I think I held up.
From what I understand, yes. Yeah, thank you, Dan.
Yeah, Dan was very good at communicating his concerns to us.
Yeah, one or two of us share those concerns.
Long story short, I think it'd be a nice thing to do for these folks. It's a hassle. It's out of norm. But that's kind of why the director and I decided.
Particularly this year.
Yeah, director and I decided.
So among these options, then, what do you think is the one?
In terms of option one or two?
Yeah.
Well, I think you have time to take testimony on that. This is simply to go to notice.
Right.
We actually have a rulemaking ready to go.
Sure.
The memo documents essentially what's in it. The question is, do you want to consider this for change? If so, we would ask that
so
you allow us
to notice on
yes.
both options.
Yeah, you don't have to make
a
decision today.
And we're prepared to do that.
Okay.
John. Okay, good. All right, fine.
Yeah, the only decision is, do you want to consider this? If yes, we'll file the notice.
All right. And we have no speaker cards on that. Maria, did you have anything further?
Richard, I have one thing on it.
Please, go ahead.
What if, I mean, I'm just from simplicity, because I do like the consistent regulation. I always think that that's important. What's wrong with the regulation that says, and I'm just hypothesizing here, maybe crazy, but that says 10 days prior to the commercial starting or 14 days prior to the commercial, and so whatever that date is, you just have 14 days before that every year, and you don't have to go be changing these dates. We have a policy that stays in place all the time, and then we don't have to deal with this.
One issue is, in the northern portion of the state, the statute establishes a December 1st opening unless the director delays the opening. So there's always the possibility, and we did this 2 years ago, to delay the opening until January. So then it becomes very difficult for recreational anglers to know when the season is going to open and what is the 10 days.
Why would that be more difficult for them than for commercial fishermen to know when it starts?
Well, the commercial fishery is a very small group of people. The recreational anglers, they come from out of state. They come from other counties. They may not be paying attention to those things.
Okay, well, I would lean towards something like that because I think it's a nice compromise that you guys have a fixed date, and then if they move it to January 1, then it becomes, if it's 14 days or 15 days, it's December 15th. If it's November, you know.
I think that's actually
your date, but
I think that's actually
I'm inclined to at least hear it.
Nancy, I think you were going to make a comment from the enforcement perspective.
It just becomes very difficult. We publish sport regulations, and if we could use a set date like the second Saturday of the month, then everybody knows what it is every year. If it's a date that changes dependent upon the season, whether it's December 1st or into January, then it becomes very hard to enforce any of that within the courts because people can always say, but, you know, I thought it was open, and the courts are better with hard dates like a second Saturday rather than something that moves dependent on the season for check, sport fishery.
Check the website. Doesn't work for the courts,
no.
I suppose.
No, it doesn't.
No. However, I would like to say this is not something we can take advantage of for this problem right at the moment, but through our regular sport fishing cycle, I do think there's a way you could structure that would exempt them from the directors setting the season back. I think there's ways to look at that, and I think we can come back to you because to hardwire that more, in other words, 14 days before, for example.
At the next cycle.
Right, at the next cycle. That's something we can look at.
Speaking of
that, I'm not
then,
stuck on 14 days.
Right,
whatever
right.
The right day is, I'm just using it as an example.
Speaking of that, what is the date certain that we would have to be back to have done all this in time to make it for this year?
You have to adopt the regulation at the September.
Actually, it would be the October meeting. We don't have a September.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I wanted to clarify on the record. Well, we wouldn't have time to adopt in September. We would need to adopt in October, I believe.
I'm going to ask, when will we get the ISOR then?
We have it. It's just a matter of noticing it.
You have it and you're fine with it, and we will have it Monday morning? Is that
yes.
what you're saying?
Yeah, it's ready.
Then we'll count out those 45 days.
Yeah, instead of counting days right now, staff will assure the commissioners that we'll do everything in our power with the department and with the Office of Administrative Law to get this through.
Right. If we have the ISO on Monday in our hands,
we should be fine if we have the ISO on Monday.
I think we'll still need to request an expedited review just in our quick process over there.
We're good.
So.
We're good.
Okay. Right, and again, this is simply to allow you to consider this change and take testimony over the next two meetings.
Okay. As we have no more speaker cards, are there any more comments or questions?
No.
Okay. I think we need a vote.
Yeah, I have a suggested motion. Fish and Game Commission hereby authorizes the staff to publish notice of the commission intent to amend Section 29.85A2A, Title 14, related to crabs, open season.
All those in favor?
Well, we need a motion. I'm sorry. That was a suggested motion.
Oh, excuse me. I need somebody to propose that motion, please.
I'll make the motion.
Second.
You're all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to number 19. Request for authorization to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 163 and 164, Title 14, commercial herring and fishery, commercial herring, fishery, and harvesting of herring eggs on kelp. Please note the discussion hearing is scheduled for August 8th in Carpinteria. And Maria, you have some words on this?
Yes, I'd like to give the commission actually one very brief slide, but there'll be three here. For the 2008-2009 herring regulations, the department has proposed a quota for San Francisco Bay of 1,118 tons, which represents 10% of the spawning biomass that we tested or saw this year. We're proposing also to change the fishing dates for the San Francisco Bay fishery. And the third thing that we are proposing is to set the Tomales Bay fishery season dates. We are not proposing any changes to quotas in Tomales Bay or in the northern part of the state. So this is pretty much a season date change to coincide with what the industry is interested in having for a season date. And there is one cleanup portion in this document that fixes a glitch with an application number in the Title 14. These recommendations were arrived at through discussions and meetings with the Director's Herring Advisory Committee, and they are supportive of these quotas and opening dates this year. One of the issues that was a discussion was the impact of the Costco Busan oil spill, which took place in the bay around the time that we typically see the spawning runs come into the bay. Luckily, they did not coincide on top of each other. However, there was impact from the oil on the habitat, and through some subsequent testing to the eggs and larvae. The Natural Resources Damage Assessment Team is looking into the effect of the oil spill on larval herring. We don't know if we're going to have that report before you make your decision for setting the quota for this season. If we do, and there is some need to reduce the quota because of potential impacts to the whole population, we would be informing you. But we feel that the information that comes out of that report is probably something that we would incorporate in our consideration for herring management in the future, this revamping of how we do herring management, to consider that information when we undertake that later on in the year. So I just wanted to alert you to the fact that there was this issue that's kind of hanging out there, but we have no information now to inform you, and if it becomes available, we will.
Thank you, Maria.
Question for Maria. Maria, I see that this spawning stock biomass for this fishery is less than a quarter of the long-term average, the 30-year average. In a situation like that, one has to ask, A, why are we allowing a fishery at all so instead of rebuilding the stock? And second, why are we allowing fishing on egg masses if we need to promote recruitment to this fishery?
The formulas that we use to determine what might be a possible surplus to harvest has been peer-reviewed, and the approach that we're taking of a 10% of the spawning biomass as an upper limit is something that also has been considered by the scientific community as a risk-averse situation.
Even with a depressed biomass?
This is not the only stock of herring on the West Coast. And so we look at things in their full complement of where they exist. We also don't feel that there is a biological risk at this level that will cause problems, and that's, I mean, we've gone through scientific review of this, and
the scientific review is the department's scientists?
No, outside the department.
What do the department scientists feel?
Same thing.
Okay.
This is a department's recommendation. Now, the industry has not been able to take that amount of fish.
Always a bad sign. You know, the only reason I ask, Maria, obviously, we've got a depressed spawning stock. We have an oil spill putting additional strain potentially on the population. And you've got a situation where the fishermen can't even catch the quota they've been given. Now, those are all really bad signs in my experience. I mean, we've seen it before in Atlantic cod and bluefin tuna where the fishermen can't even catch the quota the government gives them. It's a sign of a collapsing fishery. In this case, the department's not recommending any changes to the historical allocations for eggs on kelp and so forth. It just, you know, under these circumstances, I would kind of expect us to take the precautionary approach, either shut it down or you know, reduce it to an extent to which this population can rebuild. I don't know.
Maria, I understand that there is some interest and some discussions in the industry to shut it down. You haven't heard anything about that?
I'm unaware of that.
Yeah, I fortunately or unfortunately have a lot of history with herring fishery for a number of reasons. I have become very familiar with the biologists and the scientists who work on herring. We have an environmental document that does a very good job of covering the history of this fishery, its character, the biological characteristics, its population dynamics, and the effects of the fishery. This is our conservative recommendation. There are risks, though. As the environmental document discusses in fair detail, herring are an interesting fishery to manage. And they are influenced by a lot of factors, and there is risk. We feel this is a reasonable risk, like in any harvest. But if the commissioners want a little more background on it, if you're not comfortable with this, we can certainly give you have somebody come in and give you kind of a more detailed background on this fishery, because I know some of you are quite new to this. There are other commissioners who've been through this a few cycles. We're willing to do that. I don't want you to make a decision you're not comfortable with, though.
Well, the difficulty, I think, for us newbies, if I can speak for us newbies, which is difficult to do, is that this is perhaps the most Byzantine set of fishing regulations that perhaps exist, and that's saying quite a lot.
Yes.
I mean, frankly, this fishery has been managed damn near into extinction.
I can tell you is it has some of the most complex regulations. We have been in discussions, Maria's staff and the fishermen on DHAC. Everyone recognizes change is in order for this fishery in terms of the regulatory structure. In terms of the harvest levels, while there's still scientific debate, there is, in fact, this isn't a certainty. Our track record in other fisheries, fishing, herring, other parts of that population, scientifically believe this is an appropriate level of risk in harvest, but if you're not confident in that and want some more information, we can provide you more with that at the August meeting. Correct, Maria? Because if you're not confident, that's not a good thing.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, let me propose a way through this. Sankey, I certainly recognize that this is a small pelagic fishery. They are subject to huge swings in population size by nature, like sardines and other similar species. So I'm inclined to defer to the department here. But what we might want to do is include in the proposed regulation an option to close this if the scientists deem it necessary. In other words, instead of or a range of options, starting with what the department's proposed and going all the way to zero, if that's possible at this stage.
I have to check what's in the ISOR. I think one of the options is no fishery. But
no,
I
didn't see that. And it's also, I think we just noticed the 10% number instead of a range of 0 to 1,000 or 0 to 10%. So I don't know how much of a tweak that would require to the ISOR or to the notice.
That would at least give us the option.
But then they could, then if they were so inclined, they could... Well, we authorize staff to publish notice, and then we can vet the details.
We always have an emergency shutdown capability. We can do
that's
that.
True. Yeah, I'm inclined to do. I like what Mike's suggesting. I think we've got to listen to what our own folks are saying here, but also have the option to be taking a look. And I think it's also important to hear what Maria was saying there on the that this isn't the only fishery, and that the herring population, although down and not where we'd like to see it in the bay, that's not the case throughout the state. So I think that's an important factor here.
I agree with that. I think if we include that as an option, we can then take action based on the forthcoming report on the effects of the oil spill as well.
I agree. Okay, do we have a motion?
So my understanding is
quick question. We're slated to adopt in September, I believe, right? This change, I believe, and I have to review the ISOR, it probably will require a 45-day re-notice. That's kind of a significant change. All right, I'll work with staff. I'm just a little concerned. We have to have regulations in place. I think I'll consult with staff.
We'll count the days, but our August meeting's about 6 weeks away, which might, if we hurry.
Well, and because we're not really, we're just noticing a range, I don't know that it would require a 45-day notice.
Okay, I will take your lead on that.
15-day notice. So we got a furrowed brow here. We will check it out, though. We can still get commission authorization to go to notice. And we'll work on it.
Okay.
All right.
I have a suggested motion.
Any further questions or comments?
If I may just add one comment, commissioners, is that it would be, from what I'm understanding from the conversations, that it's a potential that range could be within that 10% figure. If there's some way to link those together, that also might help with either a 45 or 15-day notice.
Okay.
All right. John?
Suggested motion. Fish and Game Commission hereby authorizes its staff to publish notice of commission intent to amend sections 163 and 164, Title 14, related to commercial herring fishery and harvesting of herring eggs on kelp.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Second? Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you. That moves us along to item number 21, consideration and possible approval of the 2008-2009 California Duck Stamp and Ducks Unlimited Matching Aid to Restore State Habitats, also known as MARSH projects. Dan Perigary is going to present this.
Yes. We took it early.
Good morning, President Rogers.
Good morning, Commission.
Dan Perigary, the Wildlife Branch. I'm sorry. Commissioner Rogers, you weren't here for my last presentation.
From what I heard, yes.
Expressly thanked you for suggesting that I spend some time doing something more fun.
Thank you.
thank you. Steve, if we could pull up this PowerPoint. You should have in your packet a memorandum from the department itemizing a total of 23 new projects for spending pursuant to Fish and Game Code Sections 3700. Relative to the state duck stamp. And what your executive director has asked me to do today is to try to explain a little bit about our process and how we come to this list of projects, some of the partnerships that are developed and things like that. I certainly wasn't going to go through all of these 23 projects one at a time for you, but I'm certainly able to answer some questions about them should you have any.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at myself. It's pretty silly. I'm sorry I missed the presentation yesterday, but I believe you were told by Director Cook that we have artwork for this year's duck stamp. I'm personally very pleased to see that Mr. Adamson is, after his long career, able to produce a duck stamp image. The Fish and Game Code sections relative to the state duck stamp have several requirements. All adult hunters are required to possess a duck stamp. Those funds are deposited into a dedicated account. The statute stipulates that a certain amount of that funding go to Canada. We'll talk about that a little bit more. The statutes require the department review these projects relative to their feasibility and make recommendations to you, and that the commission approves the use of these projects, and that's what we're asking you to do today. The codes stipulate what projects are, and this is very important to us in that it has two main focuses, one on habitat and one on resource assessments and research, and so those are the legitimate uses of the state duck stamp account: preserve, protect, restore, enhance breeding and wintering waterfowl habitat, and then secondarily to conduct resource assessments. So our process for getting these recommendations to you is rather lengthy. About in the fall, early winter, we solicit proposals from anyone and everyone that we think has the opportunity to enhance breeding and wintering waterfowl habitat or conduct resource assessments. Those proposals come into the department usually around Valentine's Day or so. We have an outside advisory committee that consists of the Fish and Wildlife Service, a representative from CWA, and a representative from Ducks Unlimited. Those folks graciously donate their time and review this package of proposals. This year we had a total of 32 proposals that totaled about $1.7 million in projects. Those folks serve as a very good role. These are primarily habitat developers or managers, so they can look at these habitat projects in several ways, and I'll talk about those in a second. After we get some review from this outside advisory committee, the department meets, considers the recommendations and local priorities, and we come up with that list that's in front of you. And you can see there that we're recommending a total of 6 ongoing and 17 new projects. When we make these recommendations to you, we have these general considerations. We don't have a objective numeric scoring system, but certainly if it's a habitat project, is it likely to be successful? Are the costs estimated correctly? And this is one place where our advisory committee is very helpful. We have an engineer from Ducks Unlimited and a fellow from CWA that deliver habitat projects all the time. So are people estimating the yardage correctly? Are they estimating water control structures properly? Those kind of things help us decide whether these projects make sense. We ask if they're efficient. There's projects that meet those first two criteria, but they end up being $2,000 an acre. We can't go far at that kind of rate. And then, of course, we look at the local priority. We also consider the previous duck stamp funding. If a particular project area, many of these are in wildlife areas, if they've received or not received duck stamp funding in the past, we'll consider that because we try to spread the money around the state. This money comes from the duck hunters primarily in the state.
Do you have the total? Did you mention the total number that we're talking about here that you're spending?
I'm sorry, I did not. It's in your memo, and this is actually a little slippery. The governor's proposed budget has the spending authority increased to $1.3 million.
Okay.
So,
and from what?
A little over a million is what it has been.
Okay,
so,
good.
Yeah. And that's what we're doing about every year.
Sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry. And then our last sort of criteria, we look at partnerships. There's somebody bringing other people to the table to help our dollars go further.
These are the ones that
again, no numeric scores, but we consider those things. The California State Duck Stamp was the first dedicated account. It was formed in 1971, and the stamp cost a buck. We sold 141,000 of them, or 171,000 of them, in 1971. We're currently selling about 70,000 stamps annually. The price went up to $5. It went up to $7.50. It went up to $10. Up until 2003 or 4, there we did not impose those inflation criteria. We just had the stamp price stay the same. But now you can see our income is rising with those inflation things.
Dan, is this 50% decline in sales over 40 years or so reflective of the price or of the decline in actual duck hunters, do you think?
Mostly duck hunters, because the trend is similar nationwide. Of federal stamp sales, that's mostly what it is. It's actually, the scale of this is a little confusing. It's been pretty stable, really, since the early 90s at about 70,000. So even though the price has gone up, the actual sales haven't changed that much.
Dan, real quick. Did I hear that the feds were looking at increasing the federal stamp.
Yes.
Quite a bit. $25?
Bill would probably know more about it, Bill Gaines, than I do. But, yes, there is.
So if that did happen, it's possible the state might try to boost the stamp. Doesn't the state stamp kind of sometimes
Well, it would require a statute, right, since the price was set in statute originally. But, yeah, you start to wonder about the effect of the multiple price increases if you go there. Generally, our recommendations to you and the projects you funded have very strongly favored habitat, and that's just what this graph is intended to show the last 10 years or so, that we have recommended and you've spent most of the money on habitat projects. We do some resource assessment work, and we've got a little uptick due to a couple proposals this year, but the focus has been historically on habitat projects. We use DFG regions here, and this might seem a little disconcerting to some, but when you think about the distribution of waterfowl in California, most of the money, more than 50% of it's going into our Central Valley regions, 2, 3, and 4. I'm still stuck with the numbers rather than the names. And then the breeding habitat component is our region 1. And so our region 6, our inland desert region, of course, as a desert, doesn't have a lot of waterfowl habitat, but that's the sum of expenditures in those regions over the last 10 years. We are spreading the money around the state somewhat commensurate with the waterfowl resource.
So, Dan, except for the little bit that goes to Canada, you spend most of this money in California.
Every bit of it, except for the mandated part. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. On average, we do about 6,500 acres of habitat work. These are everything from restorations to what might be considered maintenance. But wetlands left unmaintained soon lose their value. So replacing levees, re-excavating channels, replacing worn-out water control structures, those are all habitat projects. This year, we're slightly above average in terms of habitat stuff. One of the important new advantages to the duck stamp is that these past projects are being used by our partners to leverage for federal North American Wetland Conservation Act dollars. The federal government usually does these grants on an annual basis. The major grants go for $1 million apiece. Ducks Unlimited's been in the habitat business a little longer, and over the last 3 years, they've taken projects that we have delivered with our permission, used them as match to a bigger project. So $500,000 of duck stamp money over the last 3 years has resulted in $6 million of NACA dollars coming to the state. CWA is kind of newer to the habitat game, and this is we're only aware of one, but we can't find the paperwork for any others, but we know CWA has used a duck stamp project as a match for at least one major NACA grant. So there's a place where those dedicated account dollars are actually bringing some bucks back on top of that. I wanted to talk specifically about the Canada part. It's kind of somewhat unusual that the state law mandated that state dollars go to Canada, and that's an obvious relation to the fact that a lot of our ducks come from there. So the statutes stipulate two and a quarter from every stamp shall go to Canada. The statutes also stipulate that be for the purposes of the North American plan and that those funds shall be matched. So some of the projects you've approved in the past, these pictures came from our partners at DU Canada. Just to give you a feel for what the prairies, unlike that slide showed you earlier that was dry and beat pretty badly, some of these easements and restored wetlands on a wet year are really phenomenal duck-producing areas. So this is an 07-08 project. Our monies were matched and partners are involved, and there's 400 acres of wetland restoration and a 10,000-acre easement. Year 06-07, the year prior, was a 3,000-acre easement. Again, it's a wet year. That really phenomenal duck country right there like that. And the matching part's pretty interesting. Most of the time, our projects have gone through DU Canada. They've got a large habitat developing kind of system in place. Our dollars that we send via Ducks Unlimited per this statute are matched by Ducks Unlimited on a one-to-one basis. Those then are applied for more NACA grants where they're matched again, and when the money crosses the border, it's matched again. So a duck stamp dollar in California can result in about $8 with exchange rates and all that stuff on the ground in Canada. Historically, Ducks Unlimited had a real heavy wetland-dependent build structures, drought-proof the prairies, and that their philosophy has really changed over the last 10 years. They're making more landscape projects, many bigger partners. The project size acres have gone up to 25,000 on average, but we have used these dollars occasionally for some pintail research projects to try and help us understand what's going on with pintail problems. So it's a chance for where that's going. And the last little thing I wanted to talk about is the resource assessment and research. In your packet are some ongoing projects where we're partnering with CWA to do some of that survey and banding work I talked about briefly relative to Western mallards and our duck populations. We have several projects that the department's actually running relative to Aleutian geese and white-fronted geese, but the duck stamp dollars are important operational dollars for things to buy, things like radio collars and things like that. And then the last thing is one that's a very unusual use of state funds. Back in the early 90s, a group of folks went to the University of California, Davis, and sought to create the Raveling Endowment. Now, Dennis Raveling was a professor of waterfowl ecology at UC Davis. He was very widely published, very widely renowned, and unfortunately passed away much too early. And these individuals felt that there was such a strong tradition of waterfowl education going on at UC Davis under Denny that needed to continue. So what they proposed to us was that duck stamp dollars be used, and we made that recommendation to the commission, and the commission did so, to create an endowment. And in over 3 years, at $100,000 a year, state duck stamp monies were put into this endowment, and they were then matched by outside contributions. And I'm sorry that this is just a scanned image of the most recent report on the Raveling Endowment, but it soon went to $1 million. They're living off the interest, and they're expending about $40,000 a year while the balance is still there. And the product of that is primarily research, and that's a legitimate use under the Act. And some of these names might not mean anything to you, but for those more familiar with the waterfowl stuff, there's a bunch of up-and-coming young waterfowl biologists that are being trained. John Eady is now the professor holding that position at UC Davis, a very, very bright and energetic fella. And so we've helped in our small way, done all these projects, and those are currently going on. And then here's a list of past students. Sean Oldenberger now works for the department. He's in our waterfowl project. Greg Yaris is working for CWA. Some of these other people are teaching at universities. And so in a small way, the duck stamp project and its role in this endowment has had a lasting effect on the training of new waterfowl biologists in the future. And it's just such an unusual thing that it's actually worked out quite well. And with that, that's really all I had there, unless there's questions on the particular projects or something.
Any questions? We do have a speaker card. Sankey?
Could you repeat, what university was that at?
I
understand there has been a bit of dialogue at these meetings relative to universities. It is that wine school.
The whining school? I'm sorry, did you say?
Well, since I take the high road, I will admit that Dennis Raveling was a great professor, and I spent some time with him and really appreciated his, you know, the students from there. I can't speak for them, but the professor, awesome, very good.
Okay, we have one
speaker card.
Except before that, I actually have one. No, yeah, one technical question while you're still up there. I was looking at the distribution of the projects by region. Is there any correlation? Because one hears this at the retail level. Is there any correlation between the efficacy of a project in Northern California and the decision by the duck to stay there?
Well, we do know that ducks are very opportunistic habitat. They've got wings and they use them, and their distribution across the continent is largely dependent on their ability to find food and sanctuary and sanctity. Duck distribution in the state of California right now is being overwhelmingly influenced by agricultural practices, particularly pertaining to rice straw decomposition. The flooding of rice stubble to decompose the straw has made a huge impact on duck distribution in the state.
Yeah, we're well aware that the rice farmers around Sacramento, who, it has anecdotally been told to us, use the evaporation off their ponds uses more water than the city of Los Angeles uses in an entire year, have managed to conduct themselves in such a manner as they look like environmentalists. That's really a very interesting twist.
We've had a few conversations at home right now relative to the smoke from the fires that are going, that remind us all that grew up in the valley of how dense the smoke could be back when they used to burn the rice straw.
Well, I think it actually is something that the commission should consider as to where those projects, in fact, are done. And if, in fact, Northern California is getting a majority of money,
And it also happens to be that in this pursuit so that they can continue doing what they do around Sacramento, the rice farmers are creating immense habitat themselves, that maybe some of that that money should be shifted to habitats further south. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, we think that we fund good projects based on their utility to ducks.
I know you do.
And you will...
But there are hunters further south.
We are well aware of that. In fact, I don't know, but the last time I asked for some information on the distribution of our duck stamp sales, there is a bunch down here. That's absolutely right. And certainly, too, particularly our Imperial Wildlife Area is in need of a tremendous amount of work.
Yes, sir.
But we are somewhat...
There are now two of us who run ducks down here.
I'll only say that we are constrained by the projects that are submitted to us. Mm. And we make a pretty strong effort to request projects.
I know you do, Dan. Thank you. Okay, we have a speaker on this who's going to come as a great shock to us all. Oh, there he is.
Bill Gaines. Thank you, Bill. And if you didn't notice, Richard, he's got a little bit of a shiner going there.
Take your cheap shot at me. Everybody else already has. But
you have something happened in the parking lot or something?
Actually, I told the commission yesterday that it was because I was fighting for wildlife and hunting arts and in our legislature. So
you got to stay out of that.
Unfortunately,
kind of
it happened in my garage, not in the
Capitol.
Yeah,
sure it did. Yeah, that's okay.
Nevertheless, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. Welcome, Commissioner Rogers. I'm pleased that you're feeling better today. And Commissioner Sutton, welcome back to the meeting today as well. First, I'm actually here to talk a little bit about the duck stamp dollars, but I would like to touch upon the rice issue that was just brought up. I wish that the 500,000 acres of rice that we have in the Sacramento Valley was being flooded because they like ducks. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, the rice growers, as you know, are under incredible pressure with air quality laws. They can't burn like they used to. They can only burn a small percentage only to control disease. I promise you that if they had the choice of burning relative to flooding, nearly all of them would burn. It's about 7 times more expensive. You know, those numbers are old, maybe 10 times more expensive to flood. So they're unfortunately just trying to stay in business. The birds are benefiting as a result, but we're working on ways. Obviously, we want to keep some of that land flooded in the long term when other uses for rice straw come about. But the birds are benefiting in the meantime, and that's necessarily a good thing. But it won't be forever, I can promise you that. They'll come up with other ways to get rid of that rice straw.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a rather large equation because there are some things that are on those fields you don't necessarily want back in the streams.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
As we're currently learning.
But when you talk about duck stamp projects or duck projects in general, when those rice fields become dry or go away, become developed, whatever it may be, and it's going to happen over time, and we're going to have to step it up to find ways to keep other types of habitat on the ground. Yesterday, Commissioner Rogers, we had a long and I thought very healthy dialogue about Senate Bill 1172, which is a piece of legislation that is sponsored by the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. It's legislation that is currently being imposed by the Department of Fish and Game. You just saw an excellent presentation from Dan Perry-Gary talking about the state duck stamp dollars. I'm going to remind the commission that the state duck stamp dollars are the only dollars, the only game-related dollars that are generated from hunters' fees that are required by statute to come in front of the Fish and Game Commission. I hope that you found that information very, very helpful. Certainly, Dan talked in detail about the partnerships that the duck stamp dollars and the statute requiring to come in front of the commission has generated with Ducks Unlimited and California Waterfowl Association, the benefits of those partnerships when it comes to putting projects on the ground, the expertise that some of those C3s have that the Department of Fish and Game may not have, the benefit of joining that expertise together, joining that project experience together, and leveraging the dollars. You heard Dan say that an 8-to-1 leveraging factor on duck stamp dollars, you know, and that is simply unmatched by any other game fund, if you will. But I want to remind you that duck stamps is the only fund that comes in front of the Fish and Game Commission. Right now, there's dollars being spent by elk hunters, bear hunters, deer hunters, wild pig hunters, bighorn sheep hunters, upland game hunters. None of those dollar expenditures come in front of the Fish and Game Commission. Frankly, you have no idea where those dollars are going. Certainly the hunting public that spends those dollars has no idea where they're going. And we're not seeing the benefit of those partnerships that we talked about for the duck stamp dollars. We're not seeing the leveraging. We're not seeing the project experience either. So I would ask the commission, if you see benefit in the duck stamp, the way that the duck stamp is handled on an annual basis, we think it makes good sense to handle all the various dedicated or the various game accounts. Make them dedicated. Make them be brought in front of the Fish and Game Commission for similar review. It only took about 10 minutes, but the benefits of that far, far exceeded the time involved by the department or the time involved in front of the Fish and Game Commission. So we would ask you to strongly consider taking a support position on 1172 for the benefit of making this data public, seeing to it that those dollars are leveraged, that the project experience from the various C3s that are out there can be brought to the table on the big game and the upland game the way they currently are being brought forward on the duck stamp dollars.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I just, not of Bill, but of Sonke. Currently, with the different tags and stamps that we have, other than the duck stamp, are any of those dollars matched by any outside groups?
Yes. In fact, many are. The most typical monies that are matched by those dollars are with federal aid grant dollars at a rate of 3-1. Every one of our sportsmen's dollars gets matched with 3 federal dollars from the PR or the SFRA fund. Mm-hmm. We do have other partnerships, not always cash, but in-kind work. So we actually have extensive partnerships, both monetary and in-kind, on lots of other funds out
awesome.
There.
Awesome. Bill, I've got given you a couple tasks here today, and I'm expecting you're going to get them to me. I would be interested your group thinks, if we took the dollars that are currently raised, how could those be leveraged? Because that's a real hook here that might help the commission understand the opportunity to generate more revenue for the support of the various different resources that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And so if you could have your group sit down and just, just send me an email and say, look, if you had this much wild pig dollars, this is how we could leverage that. I don't know what, if that's probably a bad example, but whatever.
Certainly.
You do that?
Absolutely.
And I'll share that with Sonke, of course. Everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a suggested motion.
Please go ahead.
Fish and Game Commission, suggested motion from staff. Fish and Game Commission approves the department's recommended expenditures for 2008-2009 California duck stamp funds.
Do I hear that motion?
Did you hear my motion?
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
No.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Approved.
Thank you. Moving on then to item 23A, final certification of negative declaration and adoption of findings and proposed project or alternatives for nuisance Canada goose control orders. 23B, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 503, Title 14, related to crop damage and nuisance Canada geese. Dan, from the department, do you have any comments on this?
We have another PowerPoint, but I don't know if you really want to see it or not. I can summarize a little bit here verbally that beginning in about 2004, the Fish and Wildlife Service went through an EIS process to amend their regulations relative to resident Canada geese, which they define as birds breeding in the lower 48 states. They finished their NEPA process in August 2007. We proposed rulemaking via the state statutes because existing state statutes or regulations would not allow us to implement the federal order. We have lots of growing problems with Canada geese, primarily in urban areas. The service's proposal relative to Civic Flyway in California particularly had 3 major components. It has an airport control order, which allows, and these are pretty fine points here, but the airport order allows airport managers or their agents the opportunity under certain months of the years to control geese by destroying nests and eggs, culling adults if they so think it's necessary, or translocating birds. We're recommending that you authorize the implementation of that order with the exception that the state, ask the department have the authority to control translocations. It's a very popular response to this problem, but frankly, that's why we're in this problem nationwide. The second order that the service offered is the nest and egg order, which allows private land managers to destroy the nests and eggs of Canada geese. All they have to do is register on the website. That, if you adopted that federal order in its entirety, that means anybody anywhere who believes they're having a problem with Canada geese could just go register on the service's website and go to town. Our recommendation to you is that that be implemented in the 13 coastal urban counties, the southern urban counties, where geese are not historically native to those areas. It's primarily urbanized, and the problems are most severe, particularly around the Bay Area. But that we ask that the state have some permitting authority for the other counties in the state in respect for the bird's value as a game species. And the third order is the public health control order, which says that upon certification by any state, local, or federal public health agency that these geese are posing a direct and imminent threat to human health, that all the control methods authorized under the airport order, translocate, call, nest and egg destruction, that order be implemented as it's proposed by the service. That one allows the state wildlife agency or its agents to conduct those activities. So under that order, under those federal rules, the department would have the authority to decide, does translocation make sense here or whatever makes sense. So that, in as a nutshell, is our recommendation to amend 503, which I should have started with, is action by this commission in the past to adopt the federal agricultural depredation orders. And in 503, you currently accept all federal orders relative to agricultural depredation. So because this is another federal order, we felt it made sense to just amend that section.
Thank you. Do we have any cards?
I have no public speaker cards on this one.
Any questions or comments?
Well, I noticed we had a number of letters regarding this agenda item. And curiously enough, we had letters from animal welfare groups saying this was fine with them, but we had a letter from the CWA saying it wasn't. That's sort of like backwards. Maybe Jim could explain the position on that. These are urban areas where hunting isn't allowed anyway, so I don't quite understand the opposition to this.
No, we'll get Bill.
I was wondering why I didn't see your card, Bill, because I remember a letter.
Actually, I did testify, again, Bill Gaines, California Outdoor Heritage Alliance, testifying on behalf of the California Waterfowl Association. I did testify on the Nuisance Canada Goose issue 2-3 meetings ago, and the concern of the California Waterfowl Association is they've actually done some banding studies on what a lot of people would consider urban geese and found out that they don't necessarily just stay right there at their golf course or their park. They're actually getting out and about, and a lot of them were taken in some pretty rural areas where there's a lot of hunting opportunity provided. So the concern of CWA was, wait a minute, I mean, there's some hunting opportunity here. If everybody agrees that these geese need to be trimmed in numbers, let's use hunting as one of the tools for doing it as opposed to oiling eggs and doing some of those things that nobody really likes. We have sat down with the California Department of Fish and Game in the meantime a few times and talked about this in detail. California Waterfowl is still not real happy with it, but we just understand that it's a work in progress, and it's not, we're not opposing anything that's being proposed by the department.
Bill, do bag limits make any difference as far as you guys are concerned on this?
I don't know. That's probably a better question for Dan Perry-Gary to answer. You know, our approach is specifically that these birds are getting out. They are getting out to areas that are being hunted, and they are being taken out there. So Right. They are providing hunting opportunity, and by Right. Simply killing them by other means, you know, you're taking away some of that opportunity.
Right, and I don't think anybody on the commission is opposed to the taking of Canada geese. This airport thing's a big deal, and I don't know how we can – in good conscience, not be adopting that kind of thing.
No, I understand. CWA would like to see some more options as far as maybe collecting eggs and moving the eggs and so forth and incubating them and hatching them and re-releasing them, something along those lines, as opposed to simply just doing away with them.
Yeah, there's also the human health thing.
Right.
Particularly in the Upper Bay.
Yeah.
Some problems.
Okay,
we'll continue to work with Fish and Game on this one. It's just a work in progress.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and we have no speaker cards, so any questions or comments? Suggested motion.
And please bear with me here. We have three suggested motions to work through because we have to certify the environmental document first, then certify the regs.
I understand.
First suggested motion is Fish and Game Commission hereby certifies that the final negative declaration for nuisance Canada goose control orders has been completed in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, in that it was presented to the Commission and that the Commission has reviewed and considered the information contained in the final negative declaration prior to approving the project. The certified negative declaration provides that there are no significant adverse environmental impacts resulting from the proposed project. The Commission finds, on the basis of facts in the record and the negative declaration, that the proposed project and alternatives will have no significant adverse impact.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second.
Any questions or comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next suggested motion by staff is that the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to Section 21080.5 of the Public Resources Code, hereby adopts a proposed project or alternative for the proposed regulatory action related to Section 503, Title 14, related to crop damage and nuisance Canada geese.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Unanimous.
And the final proposed suggested motion, Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by Section 355 of the Fish and Game Code and 16 U.S.C. 703 et sec, and to implement, interpret, or make specific Section 355 of the Fish and Game Code and 16 U.S.C. 703 et sec of said code, hereby amend Section 503, Title 14, related to crop damage and nuisance Canada geese. Further, the Commission directs staff to prepare a notice of determination consistent with the approval and adoption of the associated regulations. This notice of determination is to be filed with the Secretary for Resources pursuant to Section 781.5, Title 14, and Section 2180.5 of the Public Resources Code. Please note the regulatory language will be included in the Commission's website.
Do I hear the motion?
I think he said he had a comment.
Well, it's normally after the motion.
I'll make the motion.
Second.
Any comments?
Yeah. Is this the motion that, because I heard Dan, I think I heard him say, that we want, that the department wanted to have some modification on the relocation of the birds. Is this inclusive?
Dan, can you make a comment of that, please?
Dan Perigary. Our modification for addressing this is in our recommended regulatory language.
It's already there.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions?
Yeah, I just want to confirm that it's in the discussion where we are tweaking a little bit, giving the department a little more oversight. So that is, in fact, part of the package.
Yeah, we need to.
Yeah,
because it's the preferred alternative for everybody. Please come and get them and take them away. Don't do all the other stuff. And that may not always be our preference.
Right, and we simply just want
the option to do our preference. Is that correct?
It allows us to monitor what's going on, which is a key piece of this, and it gives us some discretion to say no when we see something that wanders out of bounds, if you will.
I might emphasize that by adopting this motion, we do adopt the department's full recommendations.
Perfect.
Yeah. If I could just maybe clear one thing up. The translocation alternative is extremely popular.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, it'd be more than a full-time job for lots of folks if we wanted to step into that. In reference to CWA's recommendation that be a more useful part of the alternative, where it's authorized by the feds is only in the airport control order and only in the public health order. So when someone has a problem with Canada geese at their golf course, relocations or translocations of flightless young is not permitted under the federal regulations. So the only way you can get there is via the airport order. But so we think there will be times and places where translocations make sense under those two orders. But for the general bulk of the problem in this state, it's not an option.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Do I hear a vote? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. John?
Thank you. That moves us to item 24. Discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to subsection B 91.1 of section 7.50 title 14, which is related to the Klamath River salmon sport fishing regulations. Wade Sinan from the department's northern region has some comments on this.
Thank you, commissioners, for having me here today. Again, my name is Wade Sinan. I'm from the northern part of the state, Arcata. and I'm a Humboldt State grad, just for the record.
Oh, my God. Here we go again.
Yeah, the comments that I have today is essentially the proposed changes that we've given for your consideration appear to be highly supported in our area. We've done quite a bit of outreach to the Trinity, Humboldt, and Del Norte County Soups, as well as some other groups, Trinity Management Council, folks like that. And essentially, people are happy because we're offering more this year. The proposed changes are the three fish bag, no more than two adults for fall Chinook. We've standardized our spring Chinook regulations to make it less difficult to interpret for the anglers. We've suggested a two fish bag for steelhead on the Trinity. You saw my presentation earlier for hatchery fish. We certainly have plenty of resource to accommodate that request, I believe. And we've repealed the weekly possession limit. I believe that was kind of an enforcement issue. We now have a three-day bag that is now the possession limit.
That's a good idea.
So I believe that's the bulk of the regulatory changes we proposed.
Yeah, we have no speaker cards on this. Any questions?
I wanted to ask Mr. President about a related issue on the Klamath. As you probably know, there is a recreational form of gold mining that occurs on the Klamath that involves suction dredging. And a couple of tribes, I saw a press release, I don't have it in front of me right now, but a couple of tribes and fishing organizations have objected to that based on the damage to spawning habitat, what little remains in the Klamath system. It just seems to me that, and they petitioned the governor to stop it. It just seems to me that anything that damages or potentially damages spawning habitat in these rivers, especially under the situation that we face now with salmon, ought to be curtailed. And I'd like to throw the support of the commission behind that. Can you give us any idea of how serious this is, or what the scientists think about the impact of suction dredge mining?
Well, I really can't give you personally a lot of information about that because I have not dealt with that issue. I know it's being looked at. We do have unit biologists that are responsible for reviewing some of those permits and also our ES division. I work primarily on the Trinity, and I don't see a lot of operations out there. I see a few in the main stem. So it's really hard for me to comment on, a lot of it has to do with the timing of these operations.
Sankey, do you know if the department issues those permits or if it's another agency?
No, I was about to say, actually, I have limits of what I can share. We're currently under litigation, and there's a bill on this very matter. We're working through that right now. We do issue the permits, and we hope to have some direction on that fairly soon. We are working through, like I said, some litigation.
Direction from who?
From the numerous attorneys involved in working through this issue. And the legislature, if you noticed in your bill analysis, there's a bill floating around again that would create a moratorium in certain sections and certain rivers, etc. It's all connected, and it's being negotiated right now. As soon as we have something we can share, we'll bring it forward to you.
I think it's probably fair to say the commission's intensely interested in
this. Yes, and
anything that would negatively affect the habitat of species that are under threat would be very interesting to us.
Yeah, in your regulations, there are numerous current restrictions on time of year and stretches that are closed to suction direction, where we have identified serious impacts that were unacceptable. The issue is some of these other stretches relative to the impacts are causing, and as you know, there's folks that believe it's quite harmful. We have testified that we have some concerns about that, but unfortunately the details are under litigation.
Okay. Thank you. I do have a suggested motion. We do not have speaker cards on this.
Go ahead.
Fish and Game Commission pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 200, 202, 205, 215, 220, 240, 315, and 316.5 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific Sections 200, 202, 205, 206, 215, and 316.5 of said code, hereby amend Section B91.1 of Section 7.50, Title 14, related to Klamath River sport fishing. Please note that the regulatory language will be included on the Commission's website.
Once again, this is taking the Department's recommendations. Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion?
Just a question, Mr. Please. President, or a brief comment. I've said this before, but it bears remembering that in 2006, we were in an opposite situation that we face this year, where the Klamath was the river that was problematic and was restricting, causing the closure of the West Coast salmon fisheries. And we seem to be in a boom or bust situation, where this year it's the Sacramento and the Klamath is fine. So I'll vote for this, but I am concerned about this boom and bust cycle we seem to be in. I don't know if there's any, you know, if there's anything we can do about that, but I just, it seems to me that it argues for caution here.
I'll vote for boom cycles.
Yes, can we put that into the motion?
We prefer boom cycles.
Okay.
Resolution.
So
we need a vote.
I need a vote. Do I hear the motion? Or did I have that?
I moved and Mike seconded.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
3-0 vote. Thank you. That moves us to consent calendar. We actually have a request from a member of the public to comment on two of the consent items, number 26 and 30. So we'll let him comment, and then we can consider approval of consent calendar. Mike McCorkle.
Do you want to do them both at the same time?
Yes.
Mike,
yeah,
go ahead.
Mike, you want to talk about...
Mike, make your comments on both. Good morning. At the same time.
My name is Mike McCorkle. I'm the Gillnet representative on the White Sea Bass Management Team Advisory Committee. And I just wanted to tell you today, I'll give you a little update on the 2008 season for commercial fishing. It opened on June 16th. The way I see it, and I've fished white sea bass since 1958, gill netting, hook and line, trolling. It looks like a normal year. You've got to realize that the commercial fishermen can't fish near shore anymore, so they're fishing in the open ocean now, 3 to 10, 12 miles offshore. So it's a different fishery than the fishery around Catalina and the Channel Islands. One of the things that happened this week, which is a promising sign, is that in the Santa Barbara Channel, off of Rincon Point from 4 to 5 miles, 3 tag fish were taken by commercial gill netters. 2 had the coated wire tags in their head, which are put in when the fish are very small at the hatchery, and 1 is a large, I'll call it an archival tag, one that gives the position of this fish wherever it goes. And those 3 fish were caught like 4 miles basically off of Rincon Point towards the Rock Island. So that's an interesting that the two with the tags in their head put in at the hatchery were about 12-pound fish. The one with the other tag, the positioning tag, was a 20-pound fish. So it's quite a bit older. And it's going to be interesting after this data comes out where these fish came from, especially the one with the tag, and where he's traveled to. What's happened this week is that a huge surge of warm water came into the Santa Barbara Channel, so the fish that haven't already spawned will spawn. And so the fishermen have seen that pretty much all the fish has spawned out now. And what they do that, they leave the channel. They continue on up the coast. And once they pass Point Conception, there's no fishery anymore for them. So that's an update I'd like to give you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, go ahead on item 30.
Talk about shrimp now?
Yes, please.
I just wanted to mention that the changes, proposed change in pink shrimp and trawling, we have no objection to those at all. I know that I don't really, it upsets me that the pink shrimp got closed when it did, but that's not your fault. That's the fault of the fishermen themselves for not responding to the 1459 bill, the way I see it. And I would like to just another update of the 2007-2008 Ridgeback shrimp fishery in the Santa Barbara Channel. I feel that I kind of started that fishery about 30 years ago, so I watch it real closely and very concerned about the health of that fishery. And this year's fishery was good. The stocks are good. The problem is there's no market. There's no place to sell these shrimp because of the imported shrimp has come in and caused a heck of a problem on all shrimp fishermen in the United States. So what happened this year, only four boats fish shrimp in the Santa Barbara Channel. All those shrimp were sold alive. We've developed a niche market for live shrimp that is better than dead shrimp. And actually, the Ridgeback shrimp, I think it has the most sugar content of any shrimp around, and it's a sweet, good-tasting shrimp. And so at the live market is good. The four boats were on limits, according to their buyers, from 600 to 800 pounds a day. They fished from October to the end of May, basically in the same area, and could catch that limit easily every day. So to me, the Ridgeback shrimp population is in good shape, and everything's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike, a question for you on this Ridgeback shrimp. Is this a shrimp that's similar to a spot prawn, or are we talking about a smaller shrimp?
It's about like, we'll just say, you know, they measure shrimp by size. It's about 35 to the pound.
Mm-hmm.
It has eggs inside of its back, not on its belly.
Yeah.
It lives about 5 years.
And what gear is used to take them?
What?
What type of gear is used to take the Ridgeback?
We've tried trapping them, and they don't trap. They're all taken by a trawl net, basically a small, light trawl net with no rollers, fished in muddy bottom. They're a muddy bottom shrimp. They don't live in the rocks.
That concludes public testimony. I have a suggested motion on the consent calendar.
Go ahead.
Fishing. Yes, sir.
Yes.
No. Right. I really didn't pull him off. I just allowed him to comment on them. The suggested motion is the Fish and Game Commission hereby approves its June 27, 2008 consent calendar, items number 25 through 32.
Do I hear that motion?
I move to approve them.
Second.
Any commentary? Actually, I do have a commentary. When it comes to the department's presentation, Sankey, on 28, which is the uplisting of the Delta smelt, it's on to public notice now, and we're going to be discussing this at our August meeting. One of the things that's relatively new information with respect to the health of the Delta is that ammonia issue. To what extent is the department going to be integrating that into these issues right here, these questions? I mean, is anyone doing work on that rather than simply that report that just came out, about 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, it's I don't know all the specifics, but I know this has been an issue that folks have been watching and developing some science. So are you asking for kind of an update on information we know at your August meeting?
Yeah, I certainly am. Because
sure.
From what I understand, from at least reading it on an anecdotal basis, because I've not been provided any information that's succinct and peer-reviewed, only picking it up in the press and from what we've been hearing about, this may turn out to be, the effluent from both Stockton and Sacramento may turn out to be the health problem with the Delta?
Yeah, only speculating. My understanding is it's one of many factors influencing the Delta. I don't know that there's any science that would target it as the or even
no,
be suggested.
No, I understand that. That's because it's talk about being an inconvenient truth. If I were in the had anything to do with the government of Sacramento or Stockton, and I had to look at what it might cost me to solve that problem, I think I'd want to bury it something fierce too. So I would like a free and full discussion of that, because if we are endangering the economic health of Southern California by shutting down the Clifton Court four-bay pumps, when in fact it's the effluent from the legislators' toilets that it may in fact be causing some of this, that is something that we'd like to get out into the open, into the public.
Yes, sir. We will be prepared to provide you any information we can on that situation and kind of give you again the entirety of the factors we think are influencing Longfin and why our recommendation is the way it is.
Thank you. Do I hear a vote? Are there any further comments? Go ahead, Mike, take your shot.
We will forego the Northern California, Southern California comments about water.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Unanimous.
I just wanted to check if Jordan Traverso got that sound bite for a quote. She's on it. She's already texting it. Okay, good. You know, there have been, I have to disclose this to the commissioners. I was checking YouTube recently, and there are segments pulled off of these transmissions on YouTube now, and some of them are somewhat humorous, where people actually have been cutting in commentary between our discussions. Some people might find it humorous, some might not.
Some people have a life and don't do YouTube,
right.
Anyway.
Our last item on the agenda is announcement of future meetings. August 7th and 8th, we're going to be in beautiful Carpinteria.
Actually, you won't be. You'll be in Santa Barbara.
Actually, the meeting site
is in Carpinteria?
Yes, sir.
You're kidding me.
Yep, we were able to get a nice facility in Carpinteria.
There is a nice.
I was told it was nice. We'll see. September 4th and 5th. September 4th and 5th, we are going to be in Truckee. October 2nd and 3rd, we were directed earlier yesterday by the commissioners to explore moving the Bishop meeting to the North Central Coast Study Region. So we were going to be looking at Santa Rosa for that, and we'll have an announcement.
Santa Rosa?
That's a recommendation from Commissioner Sutton. It's a central location in that study region, so we're going to be looking at that.
Maybe central in the study region, but if you have to fly in from Southern California, it's not particularly central.
It's easier to fly into than Pacifica or San Rafael, which
it
are
is?
Other options. Well, given that Pacifica and San Rafael have no airports.
You mean from your perspective?
So we'll take a look at that. That's it on the announcement of future meetings.
Because how the hell do you get there? I mean, that. Okay. All right, that's it. So any further questions or comments? Do I have a motion for adjournment?
So moved. Second.
Stand adjourned. Forget the vote.